for the healing. Go on with the dreaming. All the people in the street. And the summer's almost here. Got to go outside in the first year and walk while it's still clear. Breathing in all the way down to your stomach too. Read the lines with the radio.
To WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. What's bad for American fans is a score for Europeans. More than 150 recently locked out National Hockey League players have signed up to play in the European leagues until they get a new contract. Last week, owners locked out these players, saying their previous collective bargaining agreement was too costly. But the NHL Players Union is opposing a proposed salary cap. 47 NHL players went to the Czech League, 33 to the Russian League, and 30 to the Swedish League.
With contract negotiations basically at a deadlock, AFGE union leaders for Social Security Administration employees see only one option left: wait it out and see if the American people vote in a labor-friendly administration. Witold Spurczynski, co-chief negotiator for the SSA national contract, said that the agency has launched a full-scale assault and is trying to remove and reduce scores of benefits. Spurczynski said the SSA isn't the only branch of government being targeted.
This is being orchestrated by the Bush administration. We noticed that in other AFGE units that are in contract negotiations, their agencies are proposing similar language to strip their contracts of many of the benefits that employees have enjoyed over the years.
Spurczynski added that the only solution available if bargaining remains at a deadlock is to bring the dispute to the Federal Services Impasses Panel, a body he claims is made up of mostly anti-union Bush appointees. The negotiations, already into their 11th week, are scheduled to end by the end of November. Spurczynski said SSA officials know that the panel would most likely rule in favor of management, so the AFGE has little leverage.
I think the key element that may affect the bargaining is the election. I think if Senator Kerry wins the election, we would expect that, you know, once he becomes president, that he would have a different attitude about labor relations in the federal sector than President Bush.
An Israeli public worker general strike is costing the economy there $300 million a day. 300,000 workers are striking because 20,000 union members haven't been paid in months. Government officials won't pay up, even though they have the money, until the union accepts a program that would cut wages and cause hundreds of layoffs. The strike has shut down planes, trains, the stock exchange, banks, and post offices. Here's today's Dow Bob report. All wages are not created equal in the U.S., but now data shows that even within groups of workers with similar education and experience, there's growing wage inequity. Economic Policy Institute's State of Working America says most of the growth of wage inequality since 1979 has been driven by the growth of this within-group wage inequity. This wasn't happening from 1995 to 2000. The trend seems to contradict the idea that technology has generated greater wage inequalities by creating greater skill and education differences.
No, not the yacht.
Darling, wake up. You're having a nightmare.
Oh, it was terrible. Oh. I dreamed we lost our billions, and we were middle class.
There, there.
We were both working, and we could barely pay our bills. The children had to go to public schools. Oh. We had something called an HMO.
Oh, you poor thing.
It seems so real. We couldn't even afford my Botox.
Oh, sweetheart, go back to sleep. I'll write another campaign check tomorrow.
President George W. Bush, keeping alive the American dream. For some of us.
Easily paid for by billionaires for Bush. This is a big time for America. It's not just another election, not merely about a list of issues, even though some of those issues are huge, including the deliberate downsizing of our middle class and the deadly war of lies in Iraq. What's at stake on November 2nd is the very idea of America itself. The historic idea that we might actually build a society based on our egalitarian ideals of economic fairness, social justice, and equal opportunity for all. The moneyed elites, presently working through Bush, Cheney, Ashcroft, Rumsfeld, and company, have decided that America should no longer bother pursuing egalitarianism. They are asserting a new ethic of privilege, declaring that the role of government is to take care of the good fortunes of the few and not worry about the well-being of the many. In their view, they're the top dogs and the rest of us are just a bunch of fire hydrants. Wielding their administrative blowtorches and legislative monkey wrenches, they're jerry-rigging America's rules so that money and power flow uphill, out of our neighborhoods, into their corporate suites and offshore bank accounts. They're seizing control of every decision that affects our lives, from wages to taxation, from what's in your dinner to what's in your daily news feed, from who goes to college to who goes to war. They're turning our America, our democracy, into their America of plutocracy and autocracy. As I travel around the country, I find that most people are aware that something fundamental has gone wrong, that this is not the America they thought they were born into. I recently saw an old pickup truck with a bumper sticker that asked, "Where are we going? And what am I doing in this handbasket?" People know that we're being led down some rabbit trail off of America's true path toward egalitarianism. This is Jim Hightower saying, I believe we're in another of those when in the course of human events moments that Jefferson wrote about. It's a big time for America. Time to take our country back.
My name is James, and I want to tell you how a friend of mine changed my life. After my wife passed away, I found myself spending more and more time alone. I kept up with the daily business of living, but didn't get out as much. Didn't see friends as much. That's when I met a new friend. Sassy. Let me tell you about her. First of all, she can perform miracles. She's only a year old, weighs only 9 pounds, but she can jump up 5 times her own height. But the most impressive miracle is what a difference she's made in my life. She's my cat. I named her Sassy because I had a cat named Sassy when I was a little boy. I shared everything with that cat. What I've realized is that it doesn't matter if you're 8 or 80. We all need friends. I found my best friend, Sassy, at the ASPCA.
This is Richard Thompson, member of the board of directors of the ASPCA, encouraging you to visit your local animal shelter and adopt a cat.
Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast on terrestrial radio stations from California to North Carolina, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org. Welcome to our program. We're broadcasting live today from the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, of all places. And but that doesn't mean you can't call into the program. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. The website, www.tomhartman.com. You can drop into our chat room, which is already well-populated with an interesting conversation going on. What about third parties? What about Ralph Nader? Where should we go with this thing? You've heard me rant about this on many occasions. I thought we'd get another opinion in here. Darcy Richardson is completing a 4-volume work on third parties. The first volume, Others. The third party politics in the nation's founding to the rise and fall of the Greenback Labor Party was released earlier this year. The second volume will be released in October. Darcy Richardson, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
It's good to be here, Tom. Thank you.
I'm pleased to have you, Darcy. Darcy, first of all, I'm assuming that you're familiar with the difference. In fact, not meaning to insult you here, but that you're familiar with the difference between our form of government and proportional representation, which actually encourages third parties.
Yes. Yeah. I'm very familiar with that.
Yeah, because unfortunately most Americans aren't. You know, so it's, mm-hmm. I'm sure you're working to educate people about that, and the agony that Madison and everybody else, but Madison wrote about it in the Federalist Papers, because they hadn't figured out proportional representation of the terrible problem that would occur if there were more than two parties, because then you would almost be guaranteed an anti-democratic outcome. That is, fewer than 50% of the people would have their will exercised, as it were.
Exactly. Both John Adams and James Madison warned against too strong factions or too strong parties, and actually argued for a multiplicity of factions.
Yeah, or in the case of Madison in Federalist Number 10, he was begging people not to form factions.
Right, right.
Yeah. Please don't form those. Please let's not have political parties. So, Darcy, what's going on with Ralph Nader? You're writing about Nader here and about the horrors being inflicted upon him by the Democratic Party.
Yeah, the increasingly hostile efforts, you know, by the Democratic Party have really undermined Nader's independent candidacy this year. And in part it's due to the fact that the Democratic Party confronting probably the most nefarious, deceitful administration in U.S. history, is very united. They want to defeat George W. Bush, whom they view as almost an illegitimate president. So the party.
Darcy, I've got to interrupt you for just a second. Rama, I'm hearing an incredible hum on this line. Any idea what's causing that?
Are you still hearing it, Tom?
Yeah. No, I'm not hearing it now.
Okay, I fixed it.
Okay, Darcy, continue. I'm sorry.
Yes, because the Democratic Party is so united, it's made it almost impossible for Nader to carry on an effective, you know, independent challenge to the two-party system this year. And the Democrats have, at every opportunity, challenged his ability to even get him.
And, you know, within the context of the system?
I'm sorry. I think we were cut off there for a moment.
I'm sorry. Apparently it's popping in and out. Anyhow, don't you think that the issue, the whole problem of a third party candidacy, should be addressed at the level of the structural level, at the fact that we don't have proportional representation, we don't have instant runoff voting, instead of by people coming along and saying I'm going to be a third party candidate, even though the system is rigged for two parties?
Well, that's certainly something we should be looking at, proportional representation, and doing something about, you know, our winner-take-all system. It does discourage any kind of outside challenges to the two entrenched major parties. So definitely we should be looking at proportional representation or instant runoff voting.
Right, but the two entrenched... Go ahead.
Ralph Nader, even though he's only running at about 2% in the polls, under an instant runoff voting system, he may be the first choice of as many as 25 or 30% of the American electorate. But the two.
Yeah, I mean, I voted for him 4 years ago. This year, I think just because he seems, in my mind, increasingly to becoming something close to psychotic. I mean, he's increasingly irrational, it appears to me. And yet, I still agree with him on all the issues. I mean, you know, instant runoff voting environment, you know, I agree with you. I think he'd probably get a lot of votes. But that's not what we have right now. What we have right now is a system where whenever anybody comes in on a third party platform or as a third party candidate, they harm the other candidate to whom they're most closely aligned. They don't harm the candidate who is their polar opposite. This is essentially anti-democratic, isn't it, Darcy?
Right. That's a very true comment. And you saw that here in Florida last week when the Supreme Court ruled to put Ralph Nader on the ballot as a Reform Party candidate. The Republican lawyers in this state, including Ken Sakaya, who was one of the leading Bush attorneys in the 2000 debacle here in Florida, they were tripping all over themselves to represent the Nader campaign in their legal challenge here in Florida.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, we're fading in and out. But yeah, you see both parties, involving themselves in Nader's independent candidacy to their own, you know, benefit.
Or detriment. But see, this, right. This, you know, at when you get right down to it, though, this really isn't, about nasty Democrats or nasty Republicans sitting around going, hey, we're going to screw up this third. It's about a system that really only allows for two parties to be truly functional, isn't it?
Right. Right. Now, okay. You're absolutely right.
And yet we have Ralph Nader running around. I've had, you know, a number of people, including one of my own kids, who have heard Ralph Nader speak, where he gets up and he says, you know, in Germany they can have a third party, in Israel they can have a third party, and in Portugal they can have a third party. Why is it that the Democrats and Republicans don't want a third party candidacy here in the United States? And I consider that to be somewhere between disingenuous and a lie. Because he's not educating people about, I mean, yes, I know it's on his website and it's in his position papers, but when he gives these public speeches, he basically tries to set it up that the Democrats are out to get him, or, you know, 4 years ago the Republicans were out to get him, and that it's the fault of the parties. And it's not, it's the fault of the system, isn't it?
Yes, it is a system, absolutely.
So how then, go ahead.
You can't really fault, to a large degree, the Democrats for everything they've done this year. Even someone like Eugene McCarthy, who is you know, somewhat of a contrarian and has encouraged third-party movements in the past, even he has rallied to Kerry's side, saying that Nader reminds him of the March of Dimes looking for another cause after polio. But it's you know,
well, do you disagree with that, Darcy?
Do I agree with that?
Do you disagree with that?
I don't disagree with what McCarthy said, no. I mean, this contest is essentially between Kerry and Bush. One of them is going to occupy the White House come January 20th.
Right.
Where I was turned off with the Nader campaign this year was with his acceptance of Republican help in places like Oregon, where you're at this morning, in
right.
Michigan, and where they turned in, the Republicans collected 45,040 signatures for the Nader campaign. And then here in Florida last week, where the Republican attorneys represented Nader in court.
It just casts a bad color over the whole thing. Let's take a couple calls here. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. We're talking with Darcy Richardson, who is the author of a four-book set on third-party politics in the United States. The first, Others, Third-Party Politics from the Nation's Founding to the Rise and Fall, the Greenback Labor Party, has just come out. Engineer in Houston, Texas is on line one. Hey, Engineer?
Oh, God. Hi, Tom.
Howdy.
I hate to break. I mean, please excuse me for a tangent on the conversation, but I'm getting ready to go to Iraq and for a project, and had to listen to George this morning talk about how wonderful it is. I think it's important, as I just learned, I didn't even know this, that Iraq is not a sovereign country. It's called a military occupied zone. You do not get a visa to go there. You have to get permission from the American military.
Oh, that's interesting.
Oh, I
so I thought we handed sovereignty over.
Yes, sir. I heard that. But that's just
yeah,
not the way it is.
But that's not how it is. So you're going over there to work as an engineer, like these guys who just got their heads sawed off?
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, there's so much work in America, you know. I mean, what am I going to do? It's,
yeah.
Anyway, I could go on and on about it, but I think what the gentleman is saying is so important, and I truly agree with him, and I wish him the best of research on that.
Yeah, well, Engineer, I got to say, our prayers and hearts are with you. I mean, it's so sad that the conservative economics, starting with Ronald Reagan's war on labor in the 1980s, leading up to today, have so wiped out the American middle class that people like yourself, you know, find yourself in a position where if you want to get a good job, you've got to go to a place where you might get shot at.
The best thing is I went to an MBA program that taught that. You know, it's a game for them. You know, they have no concept of how it is impacting the worker. To them, it's nothing more than the computer strategy game. We are the little dots and dots. It's like playing Doom, but with their own real-life scale. I mean, I've seen that all the way through the program. It just annoys me. I can't believe it annoys me so much. But if it's so wonderful over there for Georgia, I just wish that he or Cheney or Rumsfeld would get in the car and drive from Baghdad to Basra.
Yeah, or let one of his two military aid daughters enlist in the Army.
Oh, there you go. But anyway, you've heard that before. So, like he used to say, lock and load, and good luck.
Okay. Well, good luck to you and Godspeed, Engineer. Thanks for calling us from Houston, Texas. I do appreciate it. Darcy, you know, Ralph has some pretty strong positions on this. Do you think that he's going to have a positive effect on Kerry and Bush and the whole discussion, or do you think that because he's so become identified as kind of the crank that he may actually be hurting the positions that he's espousing?
Well, I think with the situation in Iraq, he can push even at running at 1 or 2% in the polls. He can still push Kerry to maybe a more solid anti-war position, and that's where he can actually play a crucial role in this campaign.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, from your lips to God's ears, let's hope so. Darcy, I'd like to talk to you a little more about the history of third parties here. If you can stick around with us for just another 5 minutes, we got another segment here, but we have to take a break. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, broadcasting live from Portland, Oregon, with the all of the engineering being ably handled by Rama and Ira there in Montpelier, Vermont. Stick around. We'll be right back. 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates block out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Visit iowapeace.com for books on justice and peace. The Last Liberal Outlaw is Mike Palasek's new novel. Chuck Gregory with BlueEar.com had this to say. Palasek is at his best when writing about small-town America. It's a place he clearly loves, even as he pokes fun at its quirks and reveals the sickness that lies just below the surface. It's a place he knows, and he shares his knowledge in delightfully original ways, even as he cries out for change. We haven't had a writer like Palasek since Kurt Vonnegut was at his peak. Mike is an Iowa author, former federal prisoner for peace, small-town newspaper reporter, seminarian, and nominee for the U.S. House of Representatives in the Iowa Democratic Party 2000 election. For more information and more about Mike's other novels, visit iowapeace.com. The revolution won't be televised, but you can read about it. The Last Liberal Outlaw, A New American Revolution, is happening in the heartland.
For more than 27 years, the progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Due to the rising rate of overweight Americans, more hospitals are being forced to spend money on patient lift systems and specialized hospital beds and wheelchairs. The U.S. Center of Disease Control reports that 65% of American adults are overweight and 31% are obese. Sizewise Rentals, whom specializes in medical equipment for the obese, has reported its business growing 15 to 20% each year.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman. It's been said that if you scratch the surface of any issue of social or economic injustice, you'll find the issue of corporate power and corporate personhood. Join me for the facts on September 24th. I'll be speaking in Portland, Oregon at the Unitarian Church on Main Street at 7 p.m. For more information, call Marcia at 503-665-3957. That's 503-665-3957.
Can you imagine a world in which all kids live healthy, safe, productive, and prosperous lives? Well, that world is within our grasp, and there's a way to reach it. It's called Economics. And to learn more, just pull up DennisWeaverNow.com and learn how to get a free report of our Economics educational program and how together we can build a world of prosperity without pollution. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live, coast to coast, border to border, here from the studios of KBOO, KBOO in Portland, Oregon. And where I'll be doing an hour and a half on the air live tomorrow morning from 7:30 to 9 Pacific time as part of their fundraising drive. If you are one of our Portland listeners, and I know we have a few of them. In fact, one of them was in our chat room. Hey, is there right now? Q12 Carl. Please don't hesitate to call KBOO and kick in for what they're doing. We're talking with Darcy Richardson. Darcy is the author of a four-volume work on third parties. The first volume, Others, Third Party Politics and the Nation's Founding and the Rise and Fall of the Greenback Labor Party. Darcy, I think most people in the United States have not even heard of the Greenback Labor Party. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, the Greenback Labor Party was actually founded in the mid to late 1870s, and they were made up of currency reformers. They first ran a presidential ticket in 1876. They actually elected a number of congressmen in 1878. They had a greenback block in the U.S. House of Representatives, but the big issue was currency reform.
So was this the party that came out of the split in 1872 in the Republican Party when there was a big platform argument and basically the reformers split out of that?
Right. You had the liberal Republican movement. This was actually separate from the liberal Republican movement of 1872.
Did it come out of that, or was it just a whole
It was a separate movement altogether. Really didn't find its origins in the liberal Republican movement.
Okay.
But the 19th century, we had a number of very viable third parties, especially in the pre-Civil War days when we had the Democrats. The Whigs were the second major party, although they were in a state of disintegration. But we also had the Know-Nothing Party, which was formerly known as the American Party, and also the Anti-Slavery Free Soil Party.
Well, and the Know-Nothing Party actually controlled Massachusetts for quite a while.
Oh, yes.
I mean,
in 18th
major power.
Captured the governorship, both houses of the legislature, and elected a U.S. senator. Mm-hmm.
It's been suggested that the Know-Nothing Party's control of the legislature in Massachusetts is what led to public education, that they compulsory public education, that they, in the state of Massachusetts, they enforced compulsory public education because they were a Protestant secret society, and there were so many Catholics who'd come into Boston from Ireland after the potato famine, that they were concerned about Catholic power, and they wanted to break up the Catholic. I don't quite want to say the Catholic families, but the Catholic culture. And so they required by law that the Catholic kids had to go to schools that were essentially not Catholic schools.
It was surprisingly a very progressive legislature that the Know-Nothing Party had there in Massachusetts in the mid-1850s.
Other than their anti-Catholic agenda.
Right, yeah, their anti-Catholic, anti-immigrant stance. Right.
I mean, they were pretty hysterical about that. Let's take a quick call. We've got about a minute and a half left. Glenn in Tulsa, Oklahoma, is on line one. Hey, Glenn, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to ask you guys about the rise and what happened to the anti-Masonic Party. As a Mason, I'm interested in the history of that.
Okay, great. Thanks, Glenn. Darcy?
Yeah, the anti-Masonic Party really disappeared around 1836. Most of their members merged in with the National Republican Party. Their big appearance on the national stage actually occurred in the years 1828 to 1832. 1832, they ran a former three-term U.S. Attorney General, William Wirt, for the presidency, and Wirt took about 8% of the vote in the 1832 presidential election. The party did elect two governors, one in Vermont and Joseph Rittner in Pennsylvania. So there again, that party, like the Know-Nothing Party, did have, did elect a number of people to public office.
Interesting. So the history of the third party movement in the United States is in a lot of ways the history of poking and prodding and moving us along in appropriate directions, sometimes perhaps inappropriate directions, but they have had influence.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Okay, we've been talking with Darcy Richard. Darcy, thanks so much for being with us today. I do appreciate it. Real quickly, Darcy, is there a website you want to point people to?
I'm just setting up my website now. They can go to Amazon.com if they want to read about my book.
Okay, great. Just plug in Darcy Richardson, D-A-R-C-Y, Richardson, R-I-C-H-A-R-D-S-O-N. Darcy, thanks for being with us. It's a Tom Hartman program, 29 minutes past the hour.
This is what Ralph Nader has to say about embryonic stem cell research. That's right, not a word. John Kerry has vowed to lift the Bush administration's stifling restrictions, restrictions that could be cruelly delaying cures and treatments. Why the silence? Maybe Ralph Nader worries you might not like what he has to say. Or maybe he just doesn't care. The Committee for Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate or any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.com.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Excellent news, Americans. U.S. corporations say that they are no longer offshoring our middle-class jobs. It seems that they've grown afraid of the rising public anger at this self-serving fattening of their already ample bottom lines at the expense of working families. They fear that there will be a political backlash from workers, customers, Congress, and plain old American patriots. Does this mean that greed-headed CEOs are no longer shipping our manufacturing, professional, and high-tech jobs to India, Pakistan, Russia, and other low-wage centers? Of course not. It simply means that they no longer say the word offshoring. Instead, the doublespeak artists of corporate PR departments have coined new euphemisms. Rather than offshoring, they now call it remote global sourcing, or right-shoring, to disguise the perfidy. A new report finds that offshoring, by whatever name, is not only continuing unabated, but accelerating rapidly and expanding into new fields. If you're an architect, if you do legal work or tax preparation, if you're an editor or radiologist, say bye-bye to your professional position, for CEOs are putting these and many more on a virtual boat overseas, with about 80% of the jobs going to India, where they can get the work done for a third or less than they pay to us Americans. The report, prepared by Forrester Research, says that offshoring is increasing dramatically. Forrester's previous prediction was that the U.S. would lose 588,000 jobs to offshoring by the end of this year. Now it estimates that 830,000 will be lost, a 41% increase. Nearly half of corporations surveyed say they're either offshoring jobs now or preparing to. Well, says one offshoring specialist, so what? Quote, it's free enterprise. We're trying to make money. Yeah, and so are bank robbers. This is Jim Hightower saying the proper word for what these CEOs are doing is not offshoring, it's stealing. They're stealing America's middle-class future.
What if I told you that you could get cash back from your federal student loans? No, really. You can receive up to $1,000 cash rebate just for making your first six payments on time. Introducing College Loan Corporation's Reward. Now you can save up to 50% on your monthly payments, lock in the lowest interest rates in history, and you may be able to earn a significant rebate. That's cold hard cash in your pocket. To take advantage of this amazing offer, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
The following is brought to you by Pfizer and Viagra Sildenafil Citrate.
So this morning, I'm looking into my shaving mirror. My wife's still in bed. And this guy is staring back at me with a mischievous glint in his eye. He looks familiar. So I say, Wild Thing? Is that you? You're back.
Not all medications are for everyone, so consult with your doctor first. Then ask if Viagra is right for you. To learn more, visit Viagra.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Portland, Oregon. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. We have Joe Urus with us, or is it Urus?
It's Urus. It's Urus. For goodness sake, man.
Thank you, Joe. Joe Urus with us. He's a talk show host here on KABU in Portland, Oregon, and I want to get into a conversation with Joe. First, let's just quickly take a call here. Maybe Joe can even pop in on this. Owen in Toledo, Ohio is on line one. Hey, Owen, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Yeah, how are you doing?
I'm great. What's up with you?
You know, I this might be just venting. I was listening to your show earlier, and during one of your breaks, I switched to the Tommy Brew. She's on the Talk Right program in Sirius.
Yeah.
And I switched to her, and they're making this comment about George Bush is undermining American morale by talking down the Iraqi ship. So I tried
you mean,
to call in.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I tried to call in to express to her that Kerry isn't doing anything that is not within the American tradition when it comes to political campaign.
Yeah.
Well, what happened is that these guys are actually screening their calls. They would not let me on the show.
Yeah, surprise, surprise. And as I pointed out yesterday, I want conservatives to call me. I love it when people call who disagree with me. But see, the right wingers, their grasp on reality, their hold on what's really going. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt came right out and said it back in 1907. He said to suggest that to question the president is wrong is in itself unpatriotic. You know, the highest form of patriotism is to question what's going on in our country. We have an adversarial system. We require that.
That's right. And I tell you something. I'm a retired Marine. I spent 22 years in the Marines. And the notion that Democrats are opposed to the idea of America winning when we go to war is just disgusting, and it drives me, literally drives me out of my mind. You know,
yeah.
I want to see my our boys do good in Iraq, and I would like to see the Iraqi people benefit. But what's going on right there right now is disgraceful. And the Republicans and those who align themselves with the Republicans who try to mislead the American people are doing so at the expense of the lives of our most valued treasure. The thing that I'm upset with the Democrats about right now, the Jan Kerr people, is that they have not been aggressive and clear in presenting this message to the American people.
Yeah, absolutely, Owen. And it is. Sometimes I'm just speechless. I'm just so boggled by this. I mean, this is the Politburo strategy. This is the Joe Stalin strategy. The stifle dissent by calling them unpatriotic. This goes beyond wrong. This is, you know, what the cons are doing with the right wing talk shows and all these talking points, and what the Republican Party is trying to do by portraying anybody as disagreeing with Bush as being un-American, and by Bush referring, as he has been doing now for 4 years, to himself as the government or as the United States. Say, well, people disagree with the United States. No, I'm sorry. People disagree with George Bush. And what he is doing is the single-party rule strategy. It's the Politburo strategy. It's just absolutely wrong. Joe Uris here at KBOO. Joe, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it's, first of all, I think that there's a real misunderstanding among a lot of people. This is not the Republican Party of your parents. Pardon me. This is the Republican Party of friendly fascism. And I'm serious about that. This is a change. This is a sea change. These people took control of the mechanism of the Republican Party. They tried at various times. They gained a lot of power during the Reagan era. But now they've committed a coup on the party, and they really do control it. It's a cabal of neoconservatives who have an imperialist agenda, together with some, I know it's 30% of American people, but who are essentially religious crazies, who want to see war, they want to see the end of time, they want to see the destruction of the world. They are therefore, for example, unconcerned or even anti-environmental. They essentially want a world fantasy, which is terribly destructive to the United States, destructive to the planet.
Yeah, well said. Owen and Toledo, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894. On line three here, we've got taxi driver number 12 in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Number 12, hey, welcome to the program.
You know, you're making me homesick, because I'm from Portland, and I miss that place a whole lot.
Yeah,
really?
Beautiful country.
Yeah, I'm going back up there someday. Where are you broadcasting from?
We're in the studios of KBOO, which is the community radio station here, which doesn't carry our program because we're a commercial radio and they're non-commercial. But I'm going to be on the air here an hour and a half tomorrow morning with their fund drive, and they were kind enough to loan us a studio for 2 days.
Well, make sure to have a big old Terminator Stout beer and a slice of Marionberry pie for me while you're up there.
There you go. We'll do it.
Anyway,
so what's up, 12? Number 12?
I don't know what's up politically. You know, I just... I'm not a liberal, and I don't like Kerry, and I don't really like Bush either, but I was just more calling to say, like, you know, shout out to Portland there, and And I'm, you know, one down, two to go. The assault weapons ban is gone. The next thing that has to go is the campaign finance reform and the Patriot Act. May they all sunset and go away. That's all I have to say today.
Can I want to ask you a question. Given the situation that you really got this two-candidate choice, what are you going to do? How are you going to vote?
How am I going to vote? I really don't like Kerry, and like I said, I say all the time, what's the difference between a liberal and a conservative? Is a liberal is passive-aggressive, and a conservative is aggressive-aggressive, and they both want to control your life with their laundry list of their social agenda, and I don't like either one of them. So I may vote for the Constitution Party. I'm not really sure yet.
Yeah. Okay. Number 12, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Thanks for your comments. 1-866-889-8894. Let's go to Derek in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening to us on WTKG there in Grand Rapids. Hey, Derek, what's up?
Just calling in response to the last caller from Toledo. I thought that was one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard, that the conservatives want to see the end of the world and they want to see this destruction of the world.
Derek, that wasn't the caller from
Toledo. No, that was me.
That was Joe Uris.
I'm responsible for that one.
Who's right here in the studio with me.
Oh,
so you get to pick on him. He's right here.
Here's your chance. Go ahead, man.
I just think that's a very foolish statement to say. Anybody wants to see the end of the world. Yes, the Republican Party is.
Well, wait a minute now.
By the conservative right, but I thought that
okay,
was.
Okay, well, wait. Now, remember, I made a distinction. I talked about the neoconservatives, and then I said, and the other element of this is these religious crazies, these fanatics, who do believe in a kind of biblical prophecy of end time coming soon. Now, that is a lot of the base of George Bush. You can't argue with that, right?
I will not argue that there's a religious conservative side, and they do see the end times coming soon as part of religious prophecy, but I don't think they're doing anything to expedite the end of the world.
But they are. They really want.
Trying to say.
But you do understand, for example, that they want to use Israel in a potential war in the Middle East as the agency of bringing about God's will as they see it.
I mean, remember Alan Greenberg who went onto the Temple Mount. This was 10-12 years ago. I was actually in Israel when this happened, and set up a tent, because one of the prophecies is that the Second Temple has to be recreated, and on the site of the old temple that was Solomon's old temple, which now has a mosque over it and is covered by 200-300 feet of dirt behind the Wailing Wall. This guy goes in there. He sets up a tent so that the Messiah will come down. The Muslims, the Arabs are in there, are rather upset. He pulls out an Uzi, starts killing people. I mean, this is the intensity of this messianic thing. The Left Behind novels by Tim LaHaye and Jerry, what's his name? I mean, these books are outselling everything. Come on. Derek, you can't say that there aren't people. I mean, George Bush and Ronald Reagan both have said in public statements that they expect the end of the world to be coming in their lifetimes.
I will not disagree with you that there are a minority of people that align themselves with the conservatives and with the Republican Party that feel that way. But I think that's just you making that statement, a generalization like that statement, is the same way saying all Muslims want to destroy America because of the 19 people that bombed the Trade Center.
Yeah, no, I think we're both, Joe and I are both
saying. No, we both agree with you there. The point I'm trying to make is that there is this doomsday psychology in a large part of the population of current supporters of Bush. And this is not Republicanism. This is a peculiar kind of philosophy that has developed in the last few years and is very compelling because it offers a simple solution to complex problems.
Yeah, and it really goes back to the 1970s in large part, although there was another comparable movement back in the 1870s, Ellen White and her bunch went up on top of the mountain there. And when the world didn't end, they reinvented themselves as the Seventh-day Adventists and several other groups, Jehovah's Witnesses and whatnot, all started out as doomsday sects. But now these doomsday sects are infiltrating very aggressively and in some cases very successfully more or less mainstream or at least secondary stream Protestant denominations around the United States. I've been in some of these churches. I've heard some of these lectures where they're talking about, there's got to be a war in Israel in order for the Messiah to come back, in order for Jesus to return to the earth. And this is scary stuff, because there's people who believe this who are in a position to set up that war.
Yeah, and the other thing they do is they have this notion of exceptionalism, the idea that if you have been, if you've taken Jesus as a personal Savior and you've been saved, anything you do thereafter is sanctified. It's okay. And that peculiar exceptionalism applies to the whole country, to the whole United States in their minds. And that leaves you in a position where you don't really think logically or strategically or rationally about anything. You simply think that if you have an idea, it's God. God-guided and therefore okay.
And this is a very small minority of people, but it certainly appears that George Bush is included among them. What do you think, Derek?
Well, I think that was my major issue with it, is I believe it is a very small minority of the people. And whether George Bush is one of them or not, I can't say. I think he's definitely a little more of the on the religious conservative side than your typical conservative voter. 90+% of the conservative voters are more of the fiscal or financial conservative, and then this, you know, small percentage that seems to get all the media attention are the religious fanatic conservative right.
Let me ask you this: Do you consider George Bush's fiscal policies financially conservative? I mean, we're in debt like we've never been before.
Well, not financially. I think it's considered more of a conservative policy or more of the Ronald Reagan conservative financial policy: build up the military, spend money on the military, but cut taxes everywhere else. I think.
And leave us with a huge debt for our children and our children's children.
Come on, Derek. He's not cutting taxes. He's borrowing money from our grandchildren, giving it to people right now, particularly his wealthy buddies, and calling it a tax cut. No taxes have been cut whatsoever. Just more borrowing.
And I will give you that also, because eventually it's going to be the same situation. The only way we're going to pay back the debt is by bumping the taxes right back up,
doing away with education, Social Security, any form of medical help. I mean, which is, by the way, the conservative agenda. They say this stuff is all socialism. We need to do away with it. We had Richard Viguerie on yesterday talking about these things. So, Derek, Derek, are you going to be voting for George Bush?
At this point, I'm not really sure. I did vote for him in 2000, but I'm leaning more towards voting with the Libertarian Party this year. I'm not very happy with George Bush, but I'm not a huge fan of John Kerry as well. So I'm not positive which way I'm going to be voting.
I got to tell you, Derek, you know, the Libertarians, it's sweet what they say about individual responsibility and we should do away with laws against prostitution and the private use of drugs. But the bottom line is I think that they're more toxic than the Republicans. They think that the government should be run by huge corporations and the wealthy, rather than by we the people. How can you vote for the Libertarians?
Well, I think the Libertarian Party believes more that the government should be, its primary responsibility is to protect us from foreign invaders, and otherwise the government should stay out of our lives.
Right. So you've got a situation, for example, where we've got a large enough we have a large enough population right now that it's impossible for you to know the guy who's preparing your luncheon meats or whatever, you know, your food. In other words, you can't. It's not small town America anymore. You don't. So So we collectively got together and said, you know, we want to have an agency that is going to make sure that our food supply is clean. The Libertarians say that's government interference. That's wrong. We should simply allow corporations to do that, and we should trust them. You'd vote for that?
Okay, you raise a good point.
Yeah, I mean this is where the Libertarian argument breaks down because you know we have collectively decided, you know, we really would like to have clean air, we really would like to have water that you can drink, we would like to know that our food supply is pure, we'd like to know that our drugs are safe, and Libertarians say all of that is socialism. Maybe it is, but it's socialism that we the people in a constitutionally limited democratic republic have said we want this.
Well, and there's another element to this. Now, you need to think about this. If you don't put restrictions on the corporations, and you simply take away all the restrictions that the government currently has and allow them free reign, their motive is profit. That's their only motive. They don't have a particular morality beyond loyalty to their stockholders, if even that.
And they're not answerable to we the people. Derek, thanks for your call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. We've only got a couple seconds left or a couple minutes left in this segment. Let's move on to Dalton, Georgia, 1-866-889-8894. Curtis is on the line. Hey, Curtis, you're live with Tom Hartman here, and also Joe Uris is with us here at KBOO's studio.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. What's up, Curtis?
Hey, I just wanted to say, hey, that's a great book, What Would Jefferson Do?
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I wish it was signed, though. But anyway...
I'll tell you what. Send me an email, and I'll give you my postal address. You can mail it to me. I'll sign it and send it back to you.
Okay, I'll do that. Another thing is you know, what y'all were saying earlier about how the Christians and how this thing's going on where they think they can do anything and all that? I'm a real avid reader of the Word of God, and a few years back I started discovering that, you know, they don't even listen to their own words that they're reading out of the Word of God, you know.
I know.
Because if they really did listen to what it was saying, they got so many of these leaders that teach them that if you do everything in this certain name, either Jesus or Allah or anything, and they miss the biggest point of the Word of God, you know.
Yeah, I call it the Matthew. I call it the Matthew 25 conundrum, which basically is that if you don't in Matthew 25, Jesus is saying there's only one way to get into heaven. You got to feed the hungry, help the poor, clothe the naked, all this kind of stuff. And these guys just want to pretend that that's not even in the Bible, and that's the only place in the whole New Testament where Jesus says, "Here's what you got to do to get into heaven."
I know it. Yeah, I know it. That's right.
He was the original liberal. Somebody gave me a bumper sticker this last week and says, "Jesus, the original liberal."
Yeah, that's a good one. I wish I had that, too. But I just wanted to say thank you for writing. Yes, sir.
I appreciate it. Curtis, thanks for the call from Dalton, Georgia. Good to hear from you. We're here with Joe Uris here at KBOO, KBOO in Portland, Oregon, broadcasting live the Tom Hartman radio program with Rama and Ira ably holding down the fort there in Vermont. Stick around. We'll be right back 10 minutes before the hour.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman. Join me for a short talk and book signing on Monday, September 27th at the Barnes & Noble in South Burlington, Vermont. I'll be discussing my current book, What Would Jefferson Do? A Return to Democracy. Now, more than ever, citizens must heed the wisdom of our nation's third president. If we are to continue being the world's greatest nation, we must lead based on Jefferson's principles. For more information, call BNN Burlington at 802-864-8001. That's 802-864-8001.
Can you imagine a world in which all kids live healthy, safe, productive, and prosperous lives? Well, that world is within our grasp, and there's a way to reach it. It's called Ecolonomics. And to learn more, just pull up DennisWeaverNow.com and learn how to get a free report of our Ecolonomics educational program and how together we can build a world of prosperity without pollution. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com.
Thurston, where did you suddenly get that walkie-talkie?
I've had it all along, my dove. You see, the statute of limitations on my creative accounting is up. Time to end this tropical charade and return to our billions.
Oh, do we have to go back? It's so cozy here on the island.
My dear, don't you listen to the coconut radio? It's the best time ever to be a billionaire in America. More than half of the last tax cut went to the wealthiest 5%.
But the voters will never allow that kind of thing.
That's what's so marvelous, lovey. The middle class believes they're going to be billionaires someday.
Well, anything's possible in America.
Oh, your naivete is so charming, my love. The fact is, the gap between them and us is getting wider all the time. W's our boy.
Bush Economics. More than just a three-hour tour. Paid for by BillionairesForBush.com.
Hi, I'm David Orrick. Do you have a dust mask? Well, if you use a bagless vacuum and you're sensitive to dust, a leading consumer magazine products testing magazine warns you should wear a dust mask. But here's a better idea. Try my newest hypoallergenic 8-pound Auric XL risk-free for 30 days. It uses triple-walled disposable filter bags. Try emptying a bagless vacuum and see what happens. Dust gets all over your hands and face and back into the room and on the kitchen counter. And you get to breathe it in? I believe a vacuum should capture the dust, not your lungs. That's why with my Auric XL, the filter bags are self-sealing. What goes in the bag stays in the bag, even when you empty it. So try my hypoallergenic 8-pound Auric XL free for 30 days. Call 1-800-989-4200. 1-800-989-4200. Then if you still want a bagless vacuum, I'll send you a dust mask to...
This is a Wynn feature story. I'm Sarah Turner. The PBGC was created in 1974 to ensure protected or defined benefit plans, which are a dying breed because workers receive a guaranteed amount of money regardless of their company's investment performance. Most workers are now offered 401k plans, which are not insured and based on the whims of the stock market. Douglas Elliott is president and author of the Coffee Report.
Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation was set up like the FDIC to guarantee bank deposits. The PBGC guarantees that if you are promised a pension, that a company goes bankrupt, and there's not enough money in the pension fund, you'll still get the pension.
U.S. Airways announced on Sunday it was returning to bankruptcy for the second time after having already terminated the pilot's pension plan. And now it's revealed intentions to terminate the pensions for all of its other labor union employees.
there's a limit on how much is guaranteed. One of the limitations is that no more than, I think, $44,000 a year of pension will be guaranteed. And there are people in these unions that will earn pensions greater than that. The amount in excess of that limit, they will not receive.
In principle, corporations are required to contribute enough money to the PBGC to cover all future pension payments. But employers are getting around their obligations by abusing flexibility on the timing of their contributions.
There needs to be a different balance, either less risk being taken on or more premiums to offset that risk. And it was kind of masked in the 90s when everybody was seeming to do much better than they really were. And stock prices were high, which helped pension funds that invested in stocks. And it also made it less likely that companies would go bankrupt.
Elliott says that to date, American corporations have promised their employees more than $1.5 trillion worth of pension payments. And if they can't pay out, the burden falls on the PBGC and ultimately the U.S. taxpayer. With the Workers' Independent News Service, I'm Sarah Turner.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
It's coming through a hole in the air.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live today from Portland, Oregon. We have Joe Uris here in the studio with us. Joe is a talk show host and commentator on KBOO, also known locally and affectionately as KBOO, and or KBOO, one of the better progressive community stations in the United States. For the last 3 years, I've come out here and done fundraisers, or actually I think last year maybe we did it over the telephone. The year before last, I was out here live doing their fundraisers. And Joe, you've got tell us a little bit about this station.
Well, this station is an amazing organization, probably the oldest listener-supported station in the country, I think. Not in the corporate level of WBAI, et cetera. And it really is dependent on the efforts of the community. That's almost entirely volunteer. I think we have 10 staff people, basically technical and, maintain the management of
right.
the station.
Right.
And we do everything. We play the most wide range of music of any station that I have ever heard. And our commentary and our news broadcasting is better than 99% of what's around. And it's honest. It's open. We have talk radio 7:39 Monday through Fridays. I do a Tuesday segment with a guy named Abe Proctor, who's a great, great partner. Mm-hmm. And we want conservatives. They run from us.
I have the same problem. We book them and they say, "Are you a liberal show?" Yes. Oh, I can't go on the. I can't.
I think there's a weird two America thing going on. And I also think another thing is happening, which is, unfortunately, maybe going to influence the election, which is this perception by the mainline media that the nation is a conservative nation.
Yeah,
it's a very, very
which is nonsense. Let's take a quick call for Joe and I. Bob in Washington. Is that Washington State or Washington, D.C., Bob, on line one?
God's country, Washington, D.C.
Oh, okay. Hey, Bob. What's your question?
All of these facts are true, and I agree 100%. We had a dangerous administration in office. What I don't understand is how did we as citizens, we are responsible for putting him in an office in the first place, and if God forbid we do it again, we're even going to be more responsible. How did that happen? We weren't a repressed people like, pre-World War II Germany.
Bob, it's real simple. We were lied to. Bob, it's just real simple. He said he doesn't want to do nation building. He wants to be a compassionate conservative. He's not going to touch Social Security. He's been spending the Social Security Trust Fund. We were lied to. I mean, it's very simple, very straightforward. Bob, I'm sorry.
How did you get so gullible?
Well, I don't think it's that we're gullible. I think it's that we've got a press now that is made up of, a bunch of folks who are afraid of losing their multi-million dollar salaries for fear of questioning power. Joe, I'll give you the last 10 seconds.
All right, I just want to urge people in the Portland metro area to keep listening to KBOO 90.7 on the FM dial. Remember, we are your only alternative outside of the satellite.
There you go. Plus, keep listening to this program.
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot. Okay, this is Tom Hartman. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
While the world seems to be collapsing around us, there is hope. Tom Hartman's inspiring book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late, has just been re-released. The new updated version is available now and offers solutions to the issues that concern us most: eco-damage, genetic engineering, virulent disease, the end of cheap oil, water shortages, global famine, wars. We can still do something about it and create a world that will work for us and our children's children. As the inspiration for Leonardo DiCaprio's web movie, Global Warning, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight details what is happening to our planet, the reason for our culture's blind behavior, and how we can fix the problem. There is information. There is hope. The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late. Now with new updated information. Available in...
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. What's bad for American fans is a score for Europeans. More than 150 recently locked out National Hockey League players have signed up to play in the European leagues until they get a new contract. Last week, owners locked out these players, saying their previous collective bargaining agreement was too costly. But the NHL Players Union is opposing a proposed salary cap. 47 NHL players went to the Czech League, 33 to the Russian League, and 30 to the Swedish League.
With contract negotiations basically at a deadlock, AFGE union leaders for Social Security Administration employees see only one option left: wait it out and see if the American people vote in a labor-friendly administration. Witold Sferchinski, co-chief negotiator for the SSA national contract, said that the agency has launched a full-scale assault and is trying to remove and reduce scores of benefits. Sferchinski said the SSA isn't the only branch of government being targeted.
This is being orchestrated by the Bush administration. We noticed that in other AFGE units that are in contract negotiations, their agencies are proposing similar language to strip their contracts of many of the benefits that employees have enjoyed over the years.
Sferchinski added that the only solution available if bargaining remains at a deadlock is to bring the dispute to the Federal Services Impasses Panel, a body he claims is made up of mostly anti-union Bush appointees. The negotiations, already into their 11th week, are scheduled to end by the end of November. Sferchinski said SSA officials know that the panel would most likely rule in favor of management, so the AFGE has little leverage.
I think the key element that may affect the bargaining is the election. I think if Senator Kerry wins the election, we would expect that, you know, once he becomes president, that he would have a different attitude about labor relations in the federal sector than President Bush.
An Israeli public worker general strike is costing the economy there $300 million a day. 300,000 workers are striking because 20,000 union members haven't been paid in months. Government officials won't pay up, even though they have the money, until the union accepts a program that would cut wages and cause hundreds of layoffs. The strike has shut down planes, trains, the stock exchange, banks, and post offices. Here's today's Dow Bob report. All wages are not created equal in the U.S., but now data shows that even within groups of workers with similar education and experience, there's growing wage inequity. Economic Policy Institute's State of Working America says most of the growth of wage inequality since 1979 has been driven by the growth of this within-group wage inequity. This wasn't happening from 1995 to 2000. The trend seems to contradict the idea that technology has generated greater wage inequalities by creating greater skill and education differences.
No, not the yacht.
Darling, wake up. You're having a nightmare.
Oh, it was terrible. Oh. I dreamed we lost our billions, and we were middle class.
There, there.
We were both working, and we could barely pay our bills. The children had to go to public schools. Oh. We had something called an HMO.
Oh, you poor thing.
It seems so real. We couldn't even afford my Botox.
Oh, sweetheart, go back to sleep. I'll write another campaign check tomorrow.
President George W. Bush, keeping alive the American dream. For some of us.
Easily paid for by billionaires for Bush.
Poor Richard.
Richard Perle is a right-wing neocon theorist who wants to be taken seriously as both a governmental and corporate insider. But he keeps taking highly public pratfalls that would be absolutely comical if they weren't so ugly. Perle, who's tight with Dick Cheney and Donnie Rumsfeld, was one of the main architects of George W.'s disastrous policies in Iraq. He was the chief proponent of the fanciful notion that our invading troops would be greeted by grateful people tossing rose petals at them. Instead, angry Iraqis are tossing bombs, and more than 1,000 of our troops are dead. Richard is not doing any better in the corporate world. His latest pratfall is as a board member of Hollinger International, a media conglomerate that owns such papers as the Chicago Sun-Times and Jerusalem Post. The head honcho of Hollinger, Lord Conrad Black, now stands accused of having looted some $400 million from the corporation. Perle was not merely on the board, but on the executive committee, with a direct fiduciary responsibility to protect the interests of the shareholders. But this supposed watchdog was Lord Black's lapdog. Perle admits that he personally rubber-stamped stacks of financial documents involving Black's looting, signing the papers without even reading them. One reason that Perle was so head-in-the-sand irresponsible is that he was enjoying the corporate gravy, too. In a sweetheart deal, he directed a Hollinger division that let him pocket $3 million, even though this division lost $49 million on Perle's watch. But Richard now claims that he's a victim. After Lord Black's corporate kleptocracy was exposed, and after an internal report nailed Perle for his flagrant abdication of duty, Richard loudly proclaimed to the media that he had been duped by his former friend and benefactor. This is Jim Hightower saying, poor Richard. I guess he was duped into putting those millions into his own pockets, too.
The following is brought to you by Pfizer and Viagra Sildenafil Citrate.
So this morning, I'm looking into my shaving mirror, my wife's still in bed, and this guy is staring back at me with a mischievous glint in his eye. He looks familiar. So I say, Wild Thing? Is that you? You're back.
Not all medications are for everyone, so consult with your doctor first. Then ask if Viagra is right for you. To learn more, visit Viagra.com.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too, but who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back. Guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Broadcasting live, coast to coast, border to border, streaming around the planet, etc. You know, radiopower.org, as you well know now. So happy to be back with you. Our number, if you'd like to call in, 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, toll-free telephone number nationwide, 1-866-889-8894. If you'd like to drop into the chat room. Our chat room you can find from by going to TomHartman.com and click on the live chat button. It'll drop you in there. Don't know if you caught the story in today's New York Times. I thought this was something of considerable significance. The headline, top Shiite cleric is said to fear voting in Iraq may be delayed. An article by Dexter Filkins. And there's a text and a subtext to this that I think is very concerning, particularly in the context of the caller that we had in the last hour. I believe it was Derek in Grand Rapids, might have been Curtis in Dalton, frankly, maybe even Owen in Toledo. I'm sorry, I don't remember which caller had made the point, but that they had been listening to a conservative talk show going on and on about how anybody who says that things aren't going great in Iraq right now is somehow unpatriotic or harmful to the cause, blah-de-blah. It's if you don't acknowledge the color of the sky, if you say, hey, it's not really raining when it's raining, then this is not only wrong, it's not only wrong to say people should not speak the truth, it's anti-American. It is fundamentally anti-American. And this is what the Republicans and the cons, particularly in the talk radio business, are having to stoop to divert people's attention away from the very real issue, the absolute and utter failure of George W. Bush's policy, his attacking a country that was unarmed and represented no threat to us, that, you know, the world is full of bad rogue nations, terrorist nations, bad guys. You want a list? I mean, the list goes on and on. We just happened to pick the one that just happened to have, well, you know, as Dick Cheney so eloquently said,
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserves, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Second only in the entire world to Saudi Arabia. How many average Americans do you think know that? Do you think that that's like common knowledge? But in any case, here we've got in the New York Times today this article, the Grand Ayatollah Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Husseini al-Sistani, generally referred to as Ayatollah al-Sistani. This is the guy who is an Iranian, but he's the head Shiite. And he came into Iraq after Saddam Hussein got thrown out, and because he was persona non grata before that, because Saddam Hussein did not want a rise of the religious of any variety in his country. He was running a secular nation. Women were not wearing the veils. They could work. They, you know, girls could go to school, blah, blah, blah. Yes, he was a dictator. He's a terrible guy. And this was going on. And Sistani was persona non grata. Well, Sistani's there now. And he's not the firebrand that al-Sadr is, who's also a Shiite, who's the young Turk, as it were. Sistani is the elder statesman, and Sistani has been very patient. He's been in many ways sort of working along with us. And the reason why, of course, he's got a dog in this fight, that being democracy. If democracy happens in Iraq, then Sistani ends up being the most powerful person in the country because the Shiites are the numerical majority. And if you have a democratic election, you end up with the numerical majority taking control of the country, then surprise, surprise, you've got Sistani and his bunch having power. You've got and here now Sistani in the New York Times today, this report, is saying he's concerned that these elections are going to be delayed, but I think the headline of this story, or in the news business, what we referred to as the lead, has been buried. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 paragraphs down. In particular, these sources say, I'm quoting here from Dexter Filkin's article in today's New York Times. In particular, these sources say Ayatollah Sistani is worried about discussions now underway among those parties to form a single ticket for the elections, thus limiting the choices of voters and smothering small political parties. Are we going to end up with a Politburo, a Soviet-style election? Vote yes or no for this candidate? Or is it going to be just a very, very narrow number of candidates who are handpicked by the United States and by Paul Bremer and the like? Sistani apparently is worried about this. And I think certainly given the history of what we've done in Iraq and what we've done in many other countries around the world, perhaps we should be worried about it, too. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Al in Ypsilanti, Michigan is on line one. Hey, Al, what's up?
Hey, yeah, Tom, I listen to you every day, and I agree with a lot you say. I was calling in reference to when you related us with the Seventh-day Adventists, the Jehovah's Witnesses. We don't even believe in a political party. We pay our taxes. And
you're a Jehovah's Witness, Al?
Yes, I am. And,
okay.
And we pay our taxes. We don't believe in wars. So, I mean, I was wondering how can you label us as being one of doomsday war?
Well, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, I know that this is true about the Seventh-day Adventists, because I actually hung out with I actually went to their church for a while back, 25, 30 years ago. And Ellen White was the founder of the Seventh-day Adventists, and she believed back in the late 1800s that the world was coming to an end. She led all her people up on top of a mountaintop on this particular date. The world didn't come to an end, and so she kind of reinvented the religion. My understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that a similar scenario had played out back in the 19th century that led to the creation of the Jehovah's Witnesses. And you know, I salute you for paying your taxes.
In 1914, if you can remember, that if World War One and Two started, all the World War came about being. And our issue on that was brought to bear that at that time, the particular time before the United Nations became, and it was the World League of Nations, and they are starting to run things. And so our philosophy on the whole idea is that we are to render to Caesar what is Caesar and to God what is God. And we do not believe in wars, period. We just believe in giving love to our fellow man, helping each one as we can, and go about paying our taxes and serving our country as the laws are imposed on us. If they tell us don't run a light, we don't run a red light. We pay our taxes.
But Al, don't you think as a citizen of the United States that you also have a civic obligation to participate in the political process? Don't you think that you could understand that Jesus' injunction to render unto Caesar what is Caesar's as, you know, participate in the process? I mean, Caesar at that point in time was a dictator.
If that was the case,
then
when Jesus was on earth, he would have went to the political parties at that particular time during the Pharisees and so forth and would participate in what they would call as their government. But he did not. If we're supposed to be followers of Christ, then our whole mission is supposed to be creating love amongst fellow man and then teaching about what the Father Almighty God Jehovah has in store for us, which is life eternity, by loving one another, not by hating by the color of skin, race, creed, or religions or any factor, but loving one another and doing as he says in the scripture, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, love thy fellow man as thyself. You wouldn't want to do yourself no harm, so why would you want to harm someone even around the globe anywhere?
Al, it sounds to me like you're agreeing that Jesus was the original liberal.
Yes, he was. That was a great book that was written here recently by a black author. I can't think of his name, but if you go back to it, even when the prostitute came before and they wanted to stone her, what did he do? He just kneeled down and then told them, ye without sin cast the first stone. Nobody could cast the first stone because we all have fallen short of what God intended for us to be. And we do that every day. But
yeah, I agree. Good point, Al. Val, I appreciate your call. Thank you for setting us straight. You know, I'm not one, frankly, to bash religions. My point was that my understanding had been that the Jehovah's Witnesses had at one point been an end of days religion. I may well be wrong. I know that the Seventh-day Adventists were. From personal experience. But in any case, our daily outrage in an interview. In an interview with the Spanish paper El Mundo, White House advisor Grover Norquist. This is the guy. This is sort of the philosophical godfather of the conservatives. Grover Norquist is the guy who back 2 years ago on NPR told Mara Liasson that he didn't want to destroy American democracy, American government. He simply wanted to shrink it down to the size where he could take it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub. You know, so much for a healthy respect for the ideals of the founders, right? Grover Norquist, talking outside the United States. Remember how the cons jumped all over Bill Clinton for protesting against the Vietnam War when he was at Oxford in England? Outside the United States, he spoke poorly of our country. How dare he? Well, here we've got Grover Norquist, the ultimate con, the super con, demeaning the patriotism of World War II veterans. If you're old enough to have served in World War II, that was the generation, after all. That was the generation that brought us the New Deal, that brought us that participated in the creation of the golden age of the American middle class, the Wagner Act in 1935, the rise of unionism in the United States, protectionist legislation that kept domestic industries here. We actually used to make our own clothes here. We actually used to make the things that we use in our homes here. That generation. Grover Norquist says, I'll give you his exact quote. He said, each year, 2 million people who fought in the Second World War and lived through the Great Depression die. this generation has been an exception in American history because it has defended anti-American policies. This is Grover Norquist saying that if you're in your 70s, you're an exception to American history because, according to Grover Norquist, you defended anti-American policies. He goes on to say they are the base of the Democratic Party and they are dying. Isn't this pathetic? The sweet mask of compassionate conservatism, you rip it off and you see the horrific, ugly face of something between fascism and aristocracy. From Alexander Hamilton back in 1787, standing before the first Constitutional Convention, saying that aristocracy is the most stable form of government ever created. We must emulate it to the extent that we can in creating the Constitution. All the way up to today, Grover Norquist arguing for essentially the corporate state. Do away with government of, by, and for we the people. Let's do away with that protection, that one thing that is the barrier between us and those who would dominate us, and let's replace it with corporate power. We've been here before. We've seen this movie before. It ruled Europe for 1,000 years. It ruled Japan for 700 years. It's called feudalism, rule by the rich. Benito Mussolini reinvented it. He called it fascism. Thanks a lot, Grover, for dissing people of my father's generation who are now dying off, who fought and died for this country. 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Waitsfield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates block out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Hi, I'm David Orrick. In vacuums, bagless is a dirty word. A leading consumer testing magazine warns, if you're sensitive to dust, avoid bagless vacuums. And if you own one, they advise you to wear a dust mask. I would never put the Orrick name on a bagless vacuum. They're filthy. My hypoallergenic Orrick XL uses triple-walled disposable filter bags. They hold 4 times more than the leading brand of bagless vacuums. What goes in the Orrick bag stays in the bag, including bacteria and viruses. Empty a bagless vacuum and the dust goes right back into the room you've just cleaned. Is this sanitary? Orrick cleans the air as it vacuums the floor. Try my 8-pound Orrick XL risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-989-4200, 1-800-989-4200. It's the clean alternative to bagless vacuum.
This is what Ralph Nader has to say about embryonic stem cell research. That's right, not a word. John Kerry has vowed to lift the Bush administration's stifling restrictions, restrictions that could be cruelly delaying cures and treatments. Why the silence? Maybe Ralph Nader worries you might not like what he has to say. Or maybe he just doesn't care. The Committee for Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate or any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.com.
Hey, what does this word make you think of? Tchaikovsky.
Isn't it? So what's the word?
No, that is the word.
You lost it.
All right, who's Martha Graham?
She invented the graham cracker. Before her, there was only soda crackers.
Maybe they're not getting enough art. Kids who participate in the arts do better in school and in life. To learn more, visit AmericansForTheArts.org. Because all kids should get to appreciate Tchaikovsky's music and Martha Graham's dance. Art. Ask for more. A public service message brought to you by Americans for the Arts and the Ad Council.
Visit iowapeace.com for books on justice and peace.
The Last Liberal Outlaw is Mike Palasek's new novel. Chuck Gregory with BlueEar.com had this to say. Palasek is at his best when writing about small-town America. It's a place he clearly loves, even as he pokes fun at its quirks and reveals the sickness that lies just below the surface. It's a place he knows, and he shares his knowledge in delightfully original ways, even as he cries out for change. We haven't had a writer like Palasek since Kurt Vonnegut was at his peak. Mike is an Iowa author, former federal prisoner for peace, small-town newspaper reporter, seminarian, and nominee for the U.S. House of Representatives in the Iowa Democratic Party 2000 election. For more information and more about Mike's other novels, visit iowapeace.com. The revolution won't be televised, but you can read about it. The Last Liberal Outlaw, A New American Revolution, is happening in the heartland.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, the website, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Kofi Annan yesterday. Once again, saying that what George Bush is up to is illegal. This from the United Nations, from the New York Times, an article by Warren Hodge. Annan reiterates his misgivings about legality of war in Iraq. Now, it's interesting because the press coverage that I saw, which admittedly was very little, I didn't like sit around and listen to every single news show and all that kind of thing. I don't even remember which program it was. Basically said that they had the sense that Kofi Annan was trying to backpedal from this. But here we have this article by Warren Hodge in which he says, Secretary General Kofi Annan opened the annual United Nations debate of world leaders on Tuesday with a plea for greater observance of international law and a reminder of his misgivings about the legality of the American-led war in Iraq. Now, that seems pretty unambiguous to me. Mr. Annan, who last week told a BBC interviewer that he considered the war in Iraq, quote, illegal, end quote, because it proceeded without Security Council approval. This is another one of the big lies that the Bush administration and all the cons and all the right-wing talk shows, talk stations and whatnot, they're all telling this big lie. Oh, well, you know, we're just fulfilling Resolution 1441. Sorry, no. Resolution 1441, the one that the cons keep saying, well, this gave us authority to go into Iraq and take out Saddam. Resolution 1441 said only the Security Council could vote for war. And it could only do so if it was recommended that it do so by the weapons inspector himself. Hans Blix, in other words, was the man who held the key to 1441. And Hans Blix not only did not say, yes, it's time to go to war, he was explicitly saying the week that George Bush organized the war, well, obviously we know it was organized back 3 years earlier. In fact, it was organized before Bush even became president. But the week that George was, you know, positioning the troops and targeting the missiles and everything, Hans Blix was saying, you know, we really just need a few more weeks. And I think we can prove that there's nothing there. And you know, Colin Powell comes before the UN and he says, oh, we've got proof. You know, we've got satellite photos. We've got this. We've got informers. We've got telephone conversations. So we've and Blix says, fine. Tell me where. Give me a GPS coordinate. Tell me where. Tell me where the building is. Give me a street address. We will go there. We will take that place apart. We'll dig under the ground. We'll go in with bulldozers. We'll do whatever it takes. We're going to find these things. If you know where they are, tell us where they are, and we will get them. And what did the Bush administration say? Nothing. Not one word. Nothing. They said, oh, we're going to war. And now the cons, it's amazing how effective they have been at causing Americans to actually believe that somehow this action was authorized by the United Nations when actually the reverse is true, number one. And even more horrifying, that all the other nations of the world thought Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Because very quickly what was happening, and this is why George had to hustle into this thing, the elections notwithstanding, the reason why he had to hustle into it was because the consensus of the world very quickly was becoming, there's nothing there, there's no there there. So Kofi Annan, who last week said the war was illegal, because it proceeded, again quoting from the New York Times, proceeded without Security Council approval, stuck to the point by citing the example of Iraq in his argument about the primacy of international law and how it applied to advanced powers as well as unprincipled individuals. Here's his exact quote. Kofi Annan said, "In Iraq, we see civilians massacred in cold blood, while relief workers, journalists, and other non-combatants are taken hostage and put to death in the most barbarous fashion." He then drew a parallel to American actions. At the same time, quote, he said, "We have seen Iraqi prisoners disgracefully abused." This is in his public remarks just before George Bush spoke. Did Bush address any of this? No, not one word. No, it's all I, Claudius. I, Imperius Rex. This is such a shame. 2020. For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
With the election looming, George W. is back to claiming that he's a compassionate conservative. And as evidence, he cites his centerpiece education law, the No Child Left Behind Act. This is supposed to be a tough love reform, compelling all public school kids to pass standardized tests. If the kids fail the federal government's strict tests, they will be held back, and their schools can lose federal funding and be replaced by corporate-run chain schools. But instead of tough love, Bush's law actually is a tough luck scam, for he has callously refused to fund the reform part. To get Congress to approve the law, he had agreed to put up tax dollars for smaller classes, special teachers, tutors, educational equipment, and other resources needed for schools to improve the ability of our kids to learn and pass Bush's tests. He reneged. In this year's presidential budget proposal, George shorts his own No Child Left Behind reform by $9 billion. That's on top of $17 billion he withheld in his previous two budgets. In fact, this spring, Bush offered more of our tax dollars in the form of a bribe to try to get the government of Turkey to send some troops to Iraq than he has offered to all of America's school districts to implement his federally mandated education law. By so severely shortchanging our public schools, the Bushites can advance their ideological agenda of school privatization. As more and more schools lack the resources to achieve the passing rates required on the mandated tests, a little-known provision in Georgia's law will kick in, one that encourages states to privatize schools that fail his testing system. This is Jim Hightower saying, lest you assume that private schools will be better, thus more compassionate, recent data from Bush's own education department now reveals that children in such schools are doing worse academically than those who are in our public system. Georgia's reform is not about compassion, it's about profits.
The following is brought to you by Pfizer and Viagra Sildenafil Citrate.
So this morning, I'm looking into my shaving mirror, my wife's still in bed, and this guy is staring back at me with a mischievous glint in his eye. He looks familiar. So I say, "Wild Thing? Is that you?" You're back.
Not all medications are for everyone, so consult with your doctor first. Then ask if Viagra is right for you. To learn more, visit Viagra.com.
The
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How are you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too, but who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back, guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Portland, Oregon. Kofi Annan continuing his criticism of George W. Bush. In Iraq, we see civilians massacred in cold blood while relief workers, journalists, and other non-combatants are taken hostage and put to death in the most barbarous fashion, he says. And on it goes. 1-866-889-8894, our toll-free number if you'd like to call in and be on the program. Deborah in Santa Fe, New Mexico is on line one. Hey, Deborah, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Good to hear your voice, as always, an island of sanity in the broadcast airwaves. Well, I have a request for you, passionate request, that I just haven't heard go on, and we, you know, have to remind the American public of. Back when dear Mike Malloy was on the airwaves at KTRC, he ran sound bites of Bush talking about the trifecta. Do you remember that one?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, let me just share that with you.
You know, I was campaigning in Chicago, and somebody asked me, is there ever any time where the budget might have to go into deficit? I said, only if we were at war or had a national emergency or in recession. Little did I realize we'd get the trifecta.
Yeah, and this was an applause line at all the Republican conventions and all his speeches. And the odd thing is that he never said that. That's a lie. It was Al Gore who had said that.
Oh, really? Oh, God.
Yeah. Al Gore had actually, in answer to a question about, you know, when would he run a deficit, he had said that those were the three requirements.
Yes.
George Bush never said that and, has been challenged on that. It's just a lie. Plain old, flat out, simple.
But it was also, he said that it would be the only reason he would tap into Social Security.
Yeah. Which he's been doing, continuously. George really never addressed those issues. I mean, that's just lies on George's part, his whole trifecta thing.
Well, thanks for that. I didn't know you'd have that right at your fingertips.
Oh, yeah.
It's
amazing.
Or am I psychic?
No, it's the wonders of technology, Deborah. We've got a studio and a box here, and wherever we go, we carry George with us.
I love it. Okay, thanks, Tom.
Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. It's the bottom of the hour in our second hour of our program today. Victoria Jones is on with the Talk Radio News Service here on Line 6. Hey, Victoria, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
What's going on in Washington, D.C.?
Well, the big event here in Washington, D.C. is interim Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi addressing a joint session of Congress and then holding a lengthy press conference in the Rose Garden with President Bush, in which he painted an optimistic, some might say rosy, picture of how things are in Iraq. Of course, presidential candidate Kerry has immediately challenged that. President Bush basically saying, things are going well. When he was asked questions such as that polls of Iraqis have shown that they're not happy with the Americans being here, he immediately responded. One got the impression he may have been prepped on this, that the polls were taken before the interim government came into play, and so they weren't too relevant.
Interesting. Well, of course, he's prepped on everything. I mean, this administration lets nothing slide by. They're very careful. Careful.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Indeed. And it seems to have stood them in fairly good stead up to fairly recently. What we're starting to see in Washington is people are actually now listening to some extent to what Kerry is saying, simply because he seems to be staying on message a little bit more, even with some of the distractions from within his campaign, which the word inside Washington is he's being done no favors by Joe Lockhart and some of the others who've come on board, who seem to be, if not taking the attention away from him, at least muddying the waters.
The Clintonistas.
The Clintonistas, yes, indeed. Some of them do seem to have helped him to focus. However, for example, Terry McAuliffe has a new ad attacking Bush coming on the air, and it's not an ad that would necessarily be seen as a positive for Kerry. And so some of the questions are, well, is McAuliffe getting to call his own shots? Is Kerry in charge of this? Who is actually running things? And I think that's a question that is being asked.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to it.
Yeah. I'm wondering. Victoria, I didn't see the news conference. We were here. I'm broadcasting live today from Portland, Oregon, and it was run dash to get here to the studio, and it's the morning here actually, and I'm wondering, was it a question and answer kind of thing? Did the press get an opportunity to question Alawi, and if so, were any hard questions asked?
Yes, it was a question and answer, and yes, there were some fairly hard questions asked. But they were answered in, I won't say a very stock kind of way, but optimism was a word that was used so many times that you just really couldn't count it. And Alawi is seen as being very, very much on the same page as President Bush. Alawi talking a lot about progress in rebuilding the country and constantly talking about the contribution of Americans and the other members of the coalition, thanking America very fulsomely about how we're succeeding in Iraq, and thank you, America, and thanking us for our sacrifices and saying they're not in vain. But he also stressed how important it was that the elections were going to take place. I think he said that there'd be no greater blow to the enemies. But again, he was saying how safe it is in most areas, except for a few. And this is something that journalists who are over there are saying is just simply not true, because he's saying, you don't come and cover the progress that's being made in X, Y, and Z towns, and the journalists are saying no, because we're not allowed there. We're literally
right,
not allowed in.
So not allowed in by the American military, or not allowed in by the fact that you'll get killed if you show up?
I think a combination. I mean, some of these places are completely, at this point, inaccessible unless you go embedded. There's no way in. You would get blown up. It's simply far too unsafe to go and cover them, and journalists have tried to do that.
And so, if you go in embedded, you're only going to be carrying, you're only going to be conveying, as they say, one side of the story.
That's it. That's exactly right. And so it does seem that what he's saying there is a little bit at odds with what journalists are saying on the ground. And these are journalists who really, they're not people who want to sit in Baghdad safe, although sitting in Baghdad safe is apparently not safe. Apparently they wear helmets inside the green zone. These are people who want to get out there and cover the story and are not able to.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So what else happened in Washington today of consequence? Or is happening?
Well, that's pretty much the overwhelming story, I would say, in Washington. I mean, Congress is still in session. They had this joint session this morning. They've got probably about another week to get all their different laws written and get everything done that they can possibly do. We have heard today that we may be going to tap the emergency oil stockpile.
My October surprise prediction!
There you go.
Drive down the price of gasoline. See, I've been saying all along, it's not about the price of oil, it's about the price of gasoline. And the price of gasoline is something that can be very easily manipulated by. And then this is why Bush, even while oil is at the highest price in history, has been pumping and pumping and pumping into the strategic reserve. And I said, you just wait until the middle of September, early October, he's going to start pumping out of that reserve into the refineries, and you're going to see the price of gasoline drop 10, 15, 20, maybe even 25 cents a gallon by November 2nd.
And it's looking as though that's a possibility, not a definite, but it is a possibility.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. That's fascinating.
Amazing.
You are psychic, as the previous caller was saying. Well, she said she was psychic. But anyway, one of you is psychic.
There you go. Actually, it just seemed like logic to me, frankly. Why would he be buying all this oil when the consensus was that we had all we needed? Why is he buying all this extra oil at these absurdly high prices?
And the only answer I could come up with, other than, you know, his continuing war on America, you know, wanting to destroy the American economy, was that he wanted to have enough extra oil in the reserve that he could sell off a huge wad of it before the election in order to drive down gasoline prices without endangering the actual integrity of the reserve itself.
Mm.
And frankly, this isn't, you know, just to give the devil his due, Bill Clinton did the same thing. So it's, this is not a brand new trick. And it's just, you know, anyway. So as anything else happening, Victoria Jones, in Washington that we need to know about?
Not really. I mean, the thing people are most excited about is Cat Stevens being sent back to England, you know.
Yes, that terrible terrorist.
Terrifying terrorist, yes, who wrote
We're All Safer Train. Now. Yeah.
Being diverted to Bangor. And it is a little disconcerting that he was already on the plane. You know, I mean, if I want my potential terrorists stopped before they get on the plane.
Yes, thank you very much.
You know?
That would be, yeah, right. Oh my. I'm increasingly coming to the conclusion that most of this stuff is for show. I mean, Ralph Nader made the point 18 years ago that we need to harden the cockpit doors of our airplanes the way that El Al did. El Al did it about 20 years ago. And Ralph Nader went on this thing for, I don't know, a year or two. He was talking about it a lot. Saying, you know, and this was back when there was hijackings to Cuba, you know, and saying, you know, you want to stop hijackings, harden the cockpit doors. And the airlines didn't want to do it. It was going to cost money, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I think that's 95% of the security. That's it right there. That and the simple stuff
of part of it. Now,
yeah,
USA Today has reported today that apparently undercover investigators got explosives and weapons past security screeners at 15 airports nationwide, according to a government report.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the bottom line is nothing. There is no such thing as an absolute safety net.
No, there isn't.
And so what we need to be doing is we need to be going around the world and dealing with the root causes of terrorism. Because it doesn't just appear out of nowhere. It isn't something that, Pisces has gone into Leo. You know, let's become terrorists or something or whatever it is. There's a reason for this stuff.
Just because we're free?
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, Osama was sitting in the cave and somebody gave him a copy of the Bill of Rights and he said, "Holy cow, can you believe this? We've got to attack this country." I think not. Yeah. Victoria, thanks so much for the call. It's great to hear from you.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Keep up the great work there with the Talk Radio News Service, and we'll talk to you again soon. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. On line one, we have Scott in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, thanks very much. I think you're in a wonderful example of in Portland, Oregon there, of people, you know, paying that admission to civil society when you look at their transportation policies, mass transit, the, you know, all the open space laws that they have there. But I digress. I wanted to talk about Bush's speech yesterday. There was a fascinating detail that I heard. This was on Democracy Now! Yesterday, that no one applauded until the end. And as he was going through his speech, you know, you can tell when he's kind of been primed for, you know, when the applause is going to come in, and there's just people coughing, there's total silence.
Right, he kept pausing for his applause lines. Now in George Bush's defense, and as reluctant as I am to defend him, I would suggest that a lot of that was stump speech. I mean, there was pieces of stump speech out of there, and so he was just kind of instinctively waiting for the applause, and that the protocol in the United Nations is not to be an advocacy society. That is basically you let a person say his piece. At the end, you politely applaud, and then you have a discussion about it. So I think no matter how popular, you know, Bush had been or not been, unless he said something explicitly and specific, you know, if he got up and he said, "Okay, we've decided we're going to give a $2 billion grant to the UN," that might have gotten some applause. But you know, anything else, I think that they behaved the way that it was expected that they would behave, and to say that, you know, they sat stony-faced and then they applauded at the end as if it should have been something other than that is just a little bit, in my opinion, a little bit disingenuous. Now, I may be wrong, but I think not.
Well, I stand corrected. There was another fascinating interview on that program yesterday. There was a Canadian journalist, I believe his name is Paul Thomas. I may have his last name incorrect, Paul Johnson maybe. And he had been held hostage, for, I believe, for several weeks, and was transported from group to group who negotiated. And he talked about how unbelievably well organized the quote-unquote insurgency is, to the point where Sunnis and Shiites were meeting with Ba'athists, you know, basically everybody getting together to resist the occupation, right down to the house that he was held in. They said, well, we need to evacuate by 1 p.m. We're going to move you by 1 p.m. And at 1 p.m., his house was struck, where he had been held hostage, and he, you know, asked them point blank, how did you know? And his captors said at that point, oh, we're not going to give that away. We're not stupid. So right. What he talked about was this vast network of folks who are working to overthrow this occupation.
Yeah, increasingly, the of course, there are the deranged folks, like the guys who've been sawing off heads recently. But setting those aside for a moment, because I don't think that the majority of Iraqis even agree with that. Increasingly, the Iraqi insurgency is beginning to look like the movement of the Americans to overthrow the British. And I know that some right-winger will take that out of context and run with it, and, you know, God bless them. But it is becoming a popular revolt. You can't have this kind of activity going on without the support of a small majority of the people of a country. It just doesn't happen. Neighbors turn in neighbors, and it's not happening.
Well, you know, maybe they should not have unemployed the entire army with no jobs but with their guns.
Yeah, absolutely. But that was part of the whole neocon thing, is trying to create this conservative utopia, trying to create this whole brand new idea of you know, let's start from the ground. Here's our opportunity to get it right. Well, you know, no government intervention, no government rules, flat 15% tax, no tariffs, absolutely open borders, and we're going to have the world that Ayn Rand envisioned. And yes, sure enough, we do. And this is what it looks like. This is what you get when you have conservative economics in the extreme. You have a whole lot of really angry people. Scott, thanks for the call. Tom Hartman with you. What is it? 10 minutes before the hour.
Do you want to find out what the invasion of Iraq was really about? Read the new illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. Once you've read We the People, you'll understand why conservatives are trying to bankrupt government and how perpetual war is used as a political strategy in the United States. You'll learn how our votes are in danger and what we must do about it. You'll discover why the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 matter today. Populist watchdog and national radio commentator Jim Hightower had this to say about We the People.
Not only does this book tell you what's really going on, but it even draws you a picture of it. Read, learn, and act.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. A compelling story of how a government by and for the people has been replaced by corporate domination. Fully illustrated by Neil Cohn, We the People issues a call to action in a most entertaining way. Available in bookstores everywhere.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman. Join me for a short talk and book signing on Monday, September 27th at the Barnes & Noble in South Burlington, Vermont. I'll be discussing my current book, What Would Jefferson Do? A Return to Democracy. Now, more than ever, citizens must heed the wisdom of our nation's third president. If we are to continue being the world's greatest nation, we must lead based on Jefferson's principles. For more information, call BNN Burlington at 802-864-8001. That's 802-864-8001.
This is what Ralph Nader has to say about embryonic stem cell research. That's right, not a word. John Kerry has vowed to lift the Bush administration's stifling restrictions, restrictions that could be cruelly delaying cures and treatments. Why the silence? Maybe Ralph Nader worries you might not like what he has to say. Or maybe he just doesn't care. The Committee for Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate or any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.org.
A group hopes to persuade the federal government to drain a huge reservoir in Utah. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. When the Glen Canyon Dam was completed in 1966, it created Lake Powell, a vast reservoir stretching 186 miles from the dam in northern Arizona up through southeastern Utah. The project was controversial from the start because it submerged the scenic Glen Canyon, and it's still generating controversy today. A group of activists at the Glen Canyon Institute want to breach the dam, drain the reservoir, and let the Colorado River run free. Chip Ward writes about the effort in his new book, Hope's Horizon. He says the proposal offered in 1996 was first seen as outrageous.
Well, as it turns out, that proposal to drain Lake Powell makes an awful lot of sense. For one thing, Lake Powell traps huge amounts of sediment that have radically transformed the ecosystem downstream in the Grand Canyon. The reservoir drowned at one of the most beautiful canyon systems in the country, probably more beautiful than any national park that we have set aside. And even as a means of storing water, the lake, when it reached its fullest level, was seeing more evaporation off the surface area than water that was coming in.
Lake Powell loses 22 billion cubic feet of water to evaporation each year. Ward says that's become a critical issue.
Of course, at this point, because of this prolonged drought that we're experiencing in the West, Lake Powell has started to drain itself. It's actually down below half of its capacity at this point, and canyons that we have not seen for 20 years are suddenly reemerging from the lake and are accessible again.
The Glen Canyon proposal faces enormous resistance from Utah politicians as well as marina owners and other economic interests around Lake Powell. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
A hole in the air from those gnats in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the...
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the great metropolis of Portland, Oregon, where we're doing a book signing this afternoon, giving a speech tonight. I don't have the list in front of me. I'll get back with you on that. But anyway, it's on our website, tomhartman.com. And having a great time. Marvelous city, visiting with our daughter who lives here. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Armin in Florida is on the line. Hey, Armin, long time no talk.
Yeah, how you doing, bud?
What's up?
Yeah, I was going to tell you that a comment first, and then I'd like to tell you a couple really interesting stories that the listeners could access and read that explain, I think, most accurately the situation that we're in with Iraq right now, the truth, that is. But first, are you still with me?
You are live and on the air, Armin. I have not...
Okay. As for the world community and most open-minded Americans, the Bush supporters are the worst example of mind control. And I think it's the opinion of many people. But the two articles I think that are really worth accessing and reading that will really put some light onto what's really going on right now is if you go to the Toronto Star and access it on the September 20th article, by Linda McQuaig. It's called Crude Dudes, the article.
Yeah, Linda's great. She writes a lot of great stuff, much of which gets picked up on commondreams.org. She's been around a long time doing a great job.
But I haven't seen the detail of the information that she's put out in this article about the petroleum companies and about Cheney in 1999 in Britain, putting a plan together to go forward and compensate the Iraqi oil while he was still at Halliburton, technically.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You need to read this article. It's absolutely fantastic.
Well, Armin, put it, drop it in an email and send it to me at tom@tomhartman.com. It comes right to me. I'd love to read it.
And there's this one other one. Have you read the latest thing by William Rivers Pitt about what the media is doing to us?
No, I haven't. From truthout.org.
Right, and it's his latest article, What the Media is Doing to Us, explains in detail how General Electric owns, three or four different channels on the cable network.
Yeah, not to mention NBC. Armin, we got to wrap it up there, but I appreciate the point. We'll just refer folks to truthout.org if they want more information. It's always good to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. Broadcasting live today from Portland, Oregon. And we'll be back right after the news. Stick around.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Now, it's time for This Billionaire Moment.
A criminal investigation is underway over Halliburton's $180 million payment to Nigerian officials for a natural gas project back when Dick Cheney was the CEO. Critics call this bribery, but in many countries, bribes are just part of the political culture. Why should Dick's company be punished for being sensitive to local customs? You give money to politicians and they give favors to you. We do it all the time here in the U.S., only we call it a campaign contribution, and no one seems to object. South of the border, it's la mordita, the little bite, and in the Middle East, it's bakshish. No matter what you call it, it's smart business. I'm Xenophobe for This Billionaire Moment.
This Billionaire Moment is brought to you by BillionairesForBush.com.
Here come the billionaire!
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. What's bad for American fans is a score for Europeans. More than 150 recently locked out National Hockey League players have signed up to play in the European leagues until they get a new contract. Last week, owners locked out these players, saying their previous collective bargaining agreement was too costly. But the NHL Players Union is opposing a proposed salary cap. 47 NHL players went to the Czech League, 33 to the Russian League, and 30 to the Swedish League.
With contract negotiations basically at a deadlock, AFGE union leaders for Social Security Administration employees see only one option left: wait it out and see if the American people vote in a labor-friendly administration. Witold Sferchinski, co-chief negotiator for the SSA national contract, said that the agency has launched a full-scale assault and is trying to remove and reduce scores of benefits. Sferchinski said the SSA isn't the only branch of government being targeted.
This is being orchestrated by the Bush administration. We noticed that in other AFGE units that are in contract negotiations, their agencies are proposing similar language to strip their contracts of many of the benefits that employees have enjoyed over the years.
Sferchinski added that the only solution available if bargaining remains at a deadlock is to bring the dispute to the Federal Services Impasses Panel, a body he claims is made up of mostly anti-union Bush appointees. The negotiations, already into their 11th week, are scheduled to end by the end of November. Svirtinsky said SSA officials know that the panel would most likely rule in favor of management, so the AFGE has little leverage.
I think the key element that may affect the bargaining is the election. I think if Senator Kerry wins the election, we would expect that, you know, once he becomes president, that he would have a different attitude about labor relations in the federal sector than President Bush.
An Israeli public worker general strike is costing the economy there $300 million a day. 300,000 workers are striking because 20,000 union members haven't been paid in months. Government officials won't pay up, even though they have the money, until the union accepts a program that would cut wages and cause hundreds of layoffs. The strike has shut down planes, trains, the stock exchange, banks, and post offices. Here's today's Dow Bob report. All wages are not created equal in the U.S., but now data shows that even within groups of workers with similar education and experience, there's growing wage inequity. Economic Policy Institute's State of Working America says most of the growth of wage inequality since 1979 has been driven by the growth of this within-group wage inequity. This wasn't happening from 1995 to 2000. The trend seems to contradict the idea that technology has generated greater wage inequalities by creating greater skill and education differences.
No, not the yacht.
Darling, wake up. You're having a nightmare.
Oh, it was terrible. Oh. I dreamed we lost our billions, and we were middle class.
There, there.
We were both working, and we could barely pay our bills. The children had to go to public schools. Oh. We had something called an HMO.
Oh, you poor thing.
It seems so real. We couldn't even afford my Botox.
Oh, sweetheart, go back to sleep. I'll write another campaign check tomorrow.
President George W. Bush, keeping alive the American dream. For some of us.
Easily paid for by billionaires for Bush.
Excellent news, Americans. A new way to lie. In a nation that's gone from simple childhood fibs of my dog ate my homework to the more nefarious lies of a White House that has sent hundreds of people to die in Iraq on the false claims that Saddam Hussein was about to hit us with weapons of mass destruction, now we have new technology to extend the culture of lying to anyone with a cell phone. Yes, cell phones not only allow you to make calls or even take photographs, but also to join cells of cell phone liars who will help you cheat on your spouse, skip work, or you name it. Take the Alibi and Excuse Club, a network of some 3,400 subscribers, unknown to each other, who are willing to lie for you in exchange for you lying for them when they're in a pinch. Say you want to slip away for a weekend with a lover. What to tell your spouse? No problem. Just send out a message to the Alibi and Excuse group, and you're likely to get a volunteer who will call your spouse, posing as one of your bosses and explaining that you've been dispatched on an emergency sales mission to New York or Paris or Kalamazoo. You pay a fee to join the club, and you're also under some general obligation to return the favor when other members put out the call for a credible lie. Jumping on an entrepreneurial opportunity, others have found ways to add value to the lying phone schemes. For $2.99, for example, you can equip your cell phone to play the sounds of a rasping cough to simulate a lung infection while you're sitting on the beach sipping a cool one. You can also get honking horns and a screaming ambulance to simulate a traffic jam, thus explaining why you can't get home while you're actually chilling at a bar and watching the game. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, there could be glitches, such as if your spouse joins the same Alibi Club and takes your call for help in creating a lie so you can have an affair. Ouch.
Hi, my name is Sophie. For 5 years, I lived alone in this big house Joe and I built 35 years ago. Our girls grew up in this house. They visited every couple of weeks, and I loved seeing my grandkids, but most of the time I was on my own. Some days I didn't even go out. I just felt sad. Lonely, I guess. One day my daughter came over and said, "Get your coat, Mom. We're going for a drive." She wouldn't tell me where. When we got to the ASPCA, I got nervous. But once I met little Stevie, everything changed. Stevie's my cat. It's hard to express what a difference little Stevie's made in my life. It's mostly small things, like hearing his ridiculously loud purr. Stevie brought love back into my house. I may have saved his life, I don't know. But I do know that he made mine a lot brighter.
This is Richard Thompson, member of the board of directors of the ASPCA, encouraging you to visit your local animal shelter and adopt a cat.
calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live today from Portland, Oregon. Back in the People's Republic of Vermont, Rama and Ira ably holding down the fort, engineering the program, taking the calls, making things happen. And we're here at the studios of KABU, one of the finest community radio stations in the United States, kind enough to let us use their studios. Although I'll be doing an hour and a half fundraiser for them tomorrow morning, so for our listeners in the Portland area, be sure to participate, hang out, help out. George W. Bush and the National Guard. It seems that there's an absolutely wild sideshow going on right now. It's obvious. This absolute sideshow going on. I wrote a piece on Common Dreams a couple days ago, implying or suggesting that maybe Karl Rove had something to do with this, or it certainly you couldn't put it past him. Now you've got, I think it was Terry McAuliffe. The Democrats asking if Bob Stone had something to do with this. He was the Republican operative who was helping out Al Sharpton in the primaries, offering him zingers. Did the opposition research for him that Howard Dean didn't have any African Americans in his cabinet when he was governor of Vermont? And that sort of thing. And so, where did this come from and all? And of course, this is the sideshow on right wing talk radio all across the country right now. But the real issue that is raised in the memo, whether the memo is phony or not, has not been disputed, nor have hundreds or dozens, anyway, of other issues. And I think it's important for us to shed some light on that, to just let's get back to the basics in this issue, since the cons have said it is so important that we look into the past, the military past of John Kerry, to decide, does he have the character to be president of the United States? Let's just take a quick look at the military past of George W. Bush. And one of the people who's done one of the finest jobs of that is Eric Bollert, who's a contributor to Salon.com. Eric is with us today. Eric, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
How are you?
I'm great. What's up, Eric?
Not much.
Okay, so here we've got, let me just toss a few things here at you. This from this great article you wrote, Bush and the National Guard, a primer, depending on where in the country you went to school. And here we have, Bush flew for the last time on April 16, 1972. Upon entering the Guard, Bush agreed to fly for 60 months. After his training was completed, he owed 53 months of flying. But he flew for what?
22 months.
Eric. 22. There you go.
That's right.
I don't mean to run this as a Jeopardy game here. Tell us about this. We had a con on a couple days ago who was going, well, you know, it doesn't matter because he had enough points to graduate or to get his honorable discharge. First of all, a question, Eric, that perhaps you know. I have been looking for any evidence of this. When you get honorably discharged from the United States military, from any branch of the military, you get the equivalent of what looks like a diploma, and it says honorable discharge on it in big letters. I've never seen that in the media. Have you ever seen any documents that were issued at the time that George Bush was discharged indicating that he had an honorable discharge?
I have not, but there's lots of things that are unusual when you look at the Bush records. Usually when you're discharged, in lots of cases, you have a final physical, you have a final officer evaluation, none of which exist. He did stop flying in the spring of 72. He had 770 more days of obligation to serve. He didn't fulfill any of that. In the spring of 72, he also failed to take a flight physical, which, if you're a pilot in the Guard, is not something that's done casually. He went off to Alabama supposedly to work for a Senate campaign of a family friend. No indication he ever showed up to serve in Alabama. And then he came back to Texas in 73. He did a lot of makeup dates, what's called substitute service. But interestingly enough, the Guard had very strict regulations about substitute service because the whole point of the Guard unit training was to train as a cohesive unit. Substitute right. service had to be made up 15 days in advance or 30 days after. Bush got credit for substitute service up till months and months after or months and months in advance. Rich raises questions of if he ever actually did the substitute service, or if his superiors at the Texas Air National Guard just wanted to
just fill out the
get
forms.
Rid of him.
Yeah, move this guy
get
along.
Rid of
now
him
here's
and,
Eric. The reason I asked the question about the discharge was, was because it just seems to me that if he had an honorable discharge at the time. That he would have gotten that certificate, and that would be on the front page of the RNC website. And I know that the military is very liberal about taking people who receive general discharges, which is, you can get them for a general discharge for, alcoholism or, a dereliction of duty that doesn't quite fall into the realm of criminal activity.
Right.
Not unlike what George did. And if you were not convicted of a crime, if you don't do anything that makes you an enemy of the state, if you don't, blah, 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 within a period of a couple of years, then they'll just roll that thing over to an honorable discharge. If you ask them to, they'll do it even quicker than that. If you get a congressman, particularly if he happens to be your daddy asking them to, might even get it done within the first year or so. And I'm wondering, it sure looks to me like maybe this guy, maybe George W. Bush never even got an honorable discharge, that he got a general discharge that got upgraded to honorable, and then the records got destroyed. Do you think that that's a possibility, or am I just being a paranoid here?
You might be a little paranoid. I think he did get an honorable discharge.
Wouldn't be the first time.
But you have to understand at the time, in 1972, 73, the Vietnam War winding down, the military, to be kind, was sort of in a state of chaos. You had tens of thousands of people like Bush who joined the Guard to get out of Vietnam. It was clear no one else was going to be drafted to Vietnam in 73. People just walked away all over the place. The Guard was not in any mood to start, any sort of punishment or let alone court martials, certainly not for the son of a congressman. Lots of people got let go at the time for doing very little service. I think he did get an honorable discharge. But again, that is sort of the White House only defense in this debate, which has been going on, on and off this year, and it actually goes back to the 2000 campaign. I mean, they just say over and over, he got an honorable discharge, therefore there's no debate. But if you look at the context of the times in 1973, an honorable discharge means basically you're free to go. It doesn't mean you, in the case of George Bush, that you didn't take 2 years off without fulfilling your duty. You didn't fulfill your flight obligation.
It doesn't mean you served honorably, right?
Huh?
It doesn't mean that you served honorably.
It means go away. We have enough problems. We have a war we're about to officially lose. We have draft dodgers who are coming back into the country. Just go away and don't bother us. I mean, essentially that. I mean, if you look at the hundreds of documents that were released, the picture becomes clear. What's interesting about Bush is, he had to have strings pulled to get him into the Guard. He's one of the few people I know who had to have strings pulled to get him out. Most people, if they were able to avoid Vietnam, and, he joined in 68, the height of the Vietnam War, most people were relatively grateful to be flying once a month out of Houston. He took another approach, and after the spring of 72, sort of focus his time on figuring out how not to serve for the next 2 years.
1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number. We're talking with Eric Bollert, a contributor to Salon.com, the author of Bush and the National Guard, a primer. Just a few quick things here that you point out, Eric. In May of 72, Bush left the Houston National Guard base for Alabama. According to Air Force regulations, Bush was supposed to obtain prior authorization before leaving Texas, but he failed to get the authorization. In requesting a permanent transfer to a non-flying unit, Bush was supposed to sign an acknowledgement that he'd received relocation counseling. No such document exists. He was supposed to receive a certificate of satisfactory participation from his unit. He did not. He was supposed to sign and give a letter of resignation to his Texas unit commander. He did not. He was supposed to receive discharge orders from the Texas Air National Guard Adjutant General. He did not. He was supposed to receive new assignment orders from the Air Force Reserves. He did not. On his transfer request, he was asked to list his permanent address, but he wrote down a P.O. box for the campaign he was working on. On his transfer request, Bush was asked to list his Air Force specialty code, but Bush, an F-102 pilot, erroneously wrote the code for an F-89 or an F-94 pilot. Both planes had been retired at the time. Bush, an officer, made this mistake more than once on the same form. And on and on and on it goes. I mean, this What's Eric, what's the bottom line here? I mean, why should Americans care about this?
Well, you know, they can choose to care or not. I mean, whether someone's service or lack of service 35 years ago is relevant to a presidential debate is certainly open to question. Coming on the heels of the Swift boat fiasco in August, where Republicans said, you know, Kerry opened himself up to those questions because he presented himself as a war hero. I mean, Bush is the one running as the war president. He's the one that flew onto the deck of the Abraham Lincoln to announce mission accomplished. He certainly, it seems to me, opens himself up to questions about how he actually served during the war. And the bottom line is, in terms of his service, there appears to be, you know, two essential areas of fraud. One was the fraudulent transfer. Yeah, the fraudulent transfer to Alabama. All the paperwork you mentioned that was missing and all the things he didn't do. And then the substitute service, which I'm convinced was essentially fraud in that he did little, if any, of that makeup drills and was just simply awarded it by his superior.
Yeah. Eric, where you know what it boils down to for me is that when your nation is at war, and this is the soundbite that I wish the Kerry campaign would be playing ad nauseum, and I haven't heard it yet. When your nation is at war, it takes courage to stand up for your nation. When your nation is doing something that you believe is wrong, it takes even more courage to stand up to your nation. And John Kerry did both, and George Bush did neither. Isn't that a reasonable summary?
It is, and it's interesting. I mean, you know, when you think back of all the hoopla over Clinton's war activities, he clearly did not support the war and clearly did not want to serve in that war, and he went to, like a lot of people at the time, sort of extraordinary lengths to avoid it. Bush says he supported the war wholeheartedly. He and his family went to lengths to avoid it, and then he tried to spend 2 years figuring out how not to serve, and now is running as the war president. It's an unusual set of facts.
Yeah, well, and I would add to that, I'm not sure that getting a Rhodes Scholarship and then taking it and going to Oxford University is going to extreme lengths to avoid the
war.
Well,
you know, I'm just thinking about the correspondences with his local draft boards. I mean, you know, he put a lot of time and thought into it and clearly did not want to serve, did not support the war.
Yeah, but he was honest about it.
Yeah, exactly, and I think he spent as much time as any other person in his age at that time did.
Well said. Eric Bollert, the author of Bush in the National Guard, a primer. You can find it at Salon.com. Eric, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
I do appreciate it. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour. Stick around.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates block out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman. Join me for a short talk and book signing on Monday, September 27th at the Barnes & Noble in South Burlington, Vermont. I'll be discussing my current book, What Would Jefferson Do? A Return to Democracy. Now, more than ever, citizens must heed the wisdom of our nation's third president. If we are to continue being the world's greatest nation, we must lead based on Jefferson's principles. For more information, call BNN Burlington at 802-864-8001. That's 802-864-8001.
Can you imagine a world in which all kids live healthy, safe, productive, and prosperous lives? Well, that world is within our grasp, and there's a way to reach it. It's called Econonomics. And to learn more, just pull up DennisWeaverNow.com and learn how to get a free report of our Econonomics educational program and how together we can build a world of prosperity without pollution. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com.
For more than 27 years, the progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report.
The White House calls it downtime. Democrats call it vacation. But no matter how you look at it, a CBS News tally shows that Bush has been at his Crawford, Texas ranch, Camp David, or his family home in Kennebunkport 254 days since his term began in 2000. That's about 40% of his presidency. Most studies show that working Americans average only about 2 weeks of vacation each year.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive Magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Marion in our chat room asking the question, please reassure me, tell me it's 1939. No, it's not. I do, however, agree with Le Proletariat 2 that it's more like 1933. Strange times we have here. George W. Bush, Howard Dean actually wrote a column, a fascinating column here, and where was it published? I guess it just, you know, was generally distributed. Probably was picked up by newspapers around the country. Howard Dean, former governor of Vermont, a founder of Democracy for America, you know, et cetera, et cetera, wrote an article, Hidden Agenda, A National Draft in Our Future. Could it be a national draft? Howard Dean writes, a key issue for young Americans and their families to consider as they prepare to cast their votes in the upcoming presidential election is the real likelihood of a military draft being reinstated if President Bush is reelected. President Bush should tell us now whether he supports a military draft. Have you noticed he hasn't said one way or another? No, he really hasn't. I mean, it's John Edwards has come out and said, no, we're not going to have a draft. We've got, you know, better ways to deal with this. George Bush, to the best of my knowledge, has not said no. And, in fact, Howard Dean is calling him on it. He points out that the Army is now having to basically bribe people $15,000 if you sign up right now. I can hear the stampede. $15,000. I'm on my way. Yeah. They start at 10. They run from 10 to 15,000. But the bonuses are up 67%. 67% increase in the bonuses. This is the kind of challenge, this is the difficulty that they're having getting folks into these things. Reservists, of course, are being called away for longer periods, as Howard Dean notes. And in a further sign, he says, of a lack of adequate staffing, the armed forces are now in the process of calling up members of the individual ready reserves. The individual ready reserve, this is a euphemism for if you served in the military and there's a national emergency. And the language that authorizes this really does say national emergency. And there's a national emergency. Then for a period of time after you've served, depending on where you served and how you served, and, you know, there's a few variations and variables here, but broadly speaking, roughly for 8 years after you served, you can be called back up. And this is why you've got people in their 40s and 50s now being called up for service in Vietnam. This is wrong. I mean, this is absolutely, this is more than a back door draft. I mean, this is absolutely bizarre. In 2003, Dean notes, General Eric Shinseki testified before Congress that an additional 50,000 troops will be needed beyond what the Bush administration said would be necessary to stabilize Iraq after the invasion. Now, this guy was an active service general at the time, Eric Shinseki, testifying before the United States Congress. George Bush ignored him. We have the same problem in Afghanistan, by the way. Now, huge chunks of the country have been given over to the Taliban and to the warlords. Isn't it wonderful? 10 million people have registered to vote, many of them women. The reason that they're registering to vote is because the warlords who control the various territories are saying, if you don't go register to vote so that you can vote for me so I can continue to be the warlord in this area, I'm going to shoot you. Hey, this democracy in action? Not quite in Afghanistan. In fact, Afghanistan has now become the number one narco state in the world. In the world. Afghanistan just harvests the biggest opium poppy crop in the history of the human race. The Europeans are quite upset about this. It's one of the reasons that heroin, which typically would be the U.S. equivalent of $10, $15, $20 a dose, is now selling in Europe for $2 and $3 a dose, which is getting a lot of young folks. It's driving addiction, the easy availability of it. It's not just that it's cheaper. The fact that it's cheaper indicates that it's more widely available. You see, there's a relationship between price and availability. And so here we have this absolute mess, this absolute disaster being set up. And now, two bills pending in Congress about the draft. This is from the Charleston Gazette. Let me share that with you right after this break. It's just amazing what these guys are up to. And Jeff in Denver, hang on the line. We'll take your call after the break, too. 1-866-889-8894. 29 minutes past the hour.
Hi, I'm David Orrick. How do you tell if an air purifier is worth what you paid for it? Well, place a balloon over it. If the balloon flies up in the air, like it does with an Oreck air purifier, that's pure fresh air pushing it. But if it falls to the floor, there's virtually no air movement. Try my Oreck air purifier free for 90 days. Call 1-800-989-4200. 1-800-989-4200. Remember, if the balloon doesn't fly, I wouldn't buy.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Excellent news, Americans. U.S. corporations say that they are no longer offshoring our middle-class jobs. It seems that they, rather than offshoring, they now call it remote global sourcing, or right-shoring, to disguise the perfidy. A new report finds that offshoring, by whatever name, is not only continuing unabated, but accelerating rapidly and expanding into new fields. If you're an architect, if you do legal work or tax preparation, if you're an editor or radiologist, say bye-bye to your professional position. For CEOs are putting these and many more on a virtual boat overseas, with about 80% of the jobs going to India, where they can get the work done for a third or less than they pay to us Americans. The report, prepared by Forrester Research, says that offshoring is increasing dramatically. Forrester's previous prediction was that the U.S. would lose 588,000 jobs to offshoring by the end of this year. Now it estimates that 830,000 will be lost, a 41% increase. Nearly half of corporations surveyed say they're either offshoring jobs now or preparing to. Well, says one offshoring specialist, so what? Quote, it's free enterprise. We're trying to make money.
Yeah, and so are bank robbers. This is Jim Hightower saying, the proper word for what these CEOs are doing is not offshoring, it's stealing. They're stealing America's middle-class future.
What if I told you that you could get cash back from your federal student loans? No, really. You can receive up to $1,000 cash rebate just for making your first 6 payments on time. Introducing College Loan Corporation's Reward. Now you can save up to 50% on your monthly payments, lock in the lowest interest rates in history, and you may be able to earn a significant rebate. That's cold hard cash in your pocket. To take advantage of this amazing offer, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
The following is brought to you by Pfizer and Viagra Sildenafil Citrate.
So this morning, I'm looking into my shaving mirror. My wife's still in bed. And this guy is staring back at me with a mischievous glint in his eye. He looks familiar. So I say, Wild Thing? Is that you? You're back.
Not all medications are for everyone, so consult with your doctor first. Then ask if Viagra is right for you. To learn more, visit Viagra.com.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 33 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. John Kerry pointing out the obvious today. It's an article on the front page of the electronic edition of the New York Times. No doubt it'll be on the front page of tomorrow's newspaper. Alawi speaking as you heard in the last hour, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service reporting. Alawi speaking before Congress saying, all is well, everything's wonderful, isn't it great? John Kerry says, and I quote, I think the Prime Minister is obviously contradicting his own statement of a few days ago where he said the terrorists are pouring into the country. The President and the Prime Minister here obviously want to put the best face in the policy, but the fact is that the CIA estimates, the reporting, the ground operations, and the troops, all, John Kerry says, as do virtually all the reporters on Earth, all tell a different story. A very different story. Foreign terrorists are still pouring in, and they're trying to inflict damage. This is Alawi now. Okay, compare what Alawi said a couple of days ago with what he said today. What he said today is, "Don't worry, be happy, everything's fine." A couple of days ago, he said, and I quote: "Foreign terrorists are still pouring in, and they're trying to inflict damage on Iraq, to undermine Iraq, and to undermine the process, the democratic process in Iraq. And indeed, this is their last stand. So they're putting up a very severe fight in Iraq. We are winning. We will continue to win. We're going to prevail." Yeah, I remember President Diem speaking like that. Back in the 1970s, the early 1970s, maybe it was the year 1970, I'm not sure, or the late 60s. In any case, 1-866-889, what's so good about this, though, is that John Kerry has gotten into instant truth-teller mode. You know, let's get this out, and good on him, as they say in Australia. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, your thoughts on this. Jeff in Denver, Colorado on the line. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hi. One of the frustrating things we have to deal with is the lack of ability of soldiers to tell things because, you know, they can get in trouble and so forth.
Right.
And some of the ones I talk to, I get hints here and there. But the thing of the incentives they give, I think anyone who's thinking of enlisting has to be very careful. I mean, many of us have seen Fahrenheit 9-1-1 laugh or cringe when we see the recruiters going around. And one person I know who's been in the military for about a year now says virtually everything the recruiters told him was a lie.
Yeah, and, you know, well, I mean, that was true back in the 60s as well, by the way. Let me just toss that in. I had some experience with that.
It's been that way for a long time. But one of the things...
Sitting around screens to view an unlikely choice in the U.S. box office, Fahrenheit 9/11. Yeah. Everyone's watching it, says a Marine corporal in an outpost in Ramadi that is mortared by insurgents daily. It's shaping a lot of people's image of Bush. For 9 out of 10 of the people I talk to... it wouldn't matter who ran against Bush, they'd vote for them, said one U.S. soldier on duty in the southern city of Najaf, seeking out a reporter to make his views known. People are so fed up with Iraq and fed up with Bush. You know, apparently there's a dissent in the ranks, as they say. Here, another soldier in a new job says, nobody I know wants Bush. This whole war was based on lies. There's no clear definition of why we came here, says Army Specialist Nathan Swink of Quincy, Illinois. First they said we have WMD and nuclear weapons. Then it was to get Saddam Hussein out of office, then to rebuild Iraq. I want to fight for my nation and for my family to protect the United States against enemies, foreign and domestic, not to protect Iraqi civilians or deal with Saddam or Sadr's militia, he said. Specialist Swink, who comes from a family of both Democrats and Republicans, plans to vote for Kerry. Kerry protested the war in Vietnam, he says. He's the one to end this stuff to lead us to our exit in Iraq. This is pretty amazing stuff coming out of our soldiers, don't you think, Jeff?
Oh, yeah. Well, the direct information I get, with the exception of one fairly high-ranking officer, is basically very negative toward the administration, toward Bush in particular. And the one officer keeps going back and forth and can only hint at things.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, you know, the military has a long tradition of not being political, which comes from the absolute fear that the founders had, the paranoia of the military taking over the United States, the possibility of a coup of some sort. It's the reason why they put a civilian, the president, in charge of the military and the Department of Defense, rather than, you know, because they didn't want any more of these military coups like had been seen in so many other countries, like, you know, like Sharif in Pakistan, or, you know, Mubarak and his, there is this long tradition among the military of not being political. And yet, even against that, many of them are starting to speak out. I think that's unprecedented.
Well, I would just caution any person who is tempted to join the military and take advantage of its benefits, please talk to some enlisted people that have been in for a while to find out whether you really get the benefits. Don't believe the people are trying to get you in there.
Yeah, because they're playing games with that, too. Jeff, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. One Marine in, quote, we shouldn't be here. There's no reason for invading this country in the first place. We just came here and angered people and killed a lot of innocent people, said the Marine, who's seen regular combat in Ramadi. I don't enjoy killing women and children. It's not my thing. As with his comrades, the Marine accepted some of the most controversial claims of Fahrenheit 9/11, which critics have called biased. And this, quoting the Marine again, Bush didn't want to attack Osama bin Laden because he's doing business with bin Laden's family, he said. Geez, even the Marines now are starting to become conspiracy theorists. Or is it just simply the practical application of reality? Is it simply telling the truth? Chris in New Mexico has called 1-866-889-8894. Hey, Kevin, what are your thoughts? Or Chris, what are your thoughts on this? Chris on line 3.
Well, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, thank you. I watched Bush in Malawi today, and I really expected him to break into a duet of Hakuna Matata. I really did.
or Que Sera Sera.
Yeah, you know, or Don't Worry, Be Happy. George said that if we wilt and pull out of Iraq, America's security will suffer. Well, first off, I can't think of who's advocating pulling out of Iraq, certainly not John Kerry. What Kerry did say today was that planning elections when there are large areas of Iraq wherein American soldiers and Bradley fighting vehicles and Abrams tanks can't go without getting attacked is simply ridiculous. It's more so than you would have thought for a White House that plans everything so exhaustively.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, interesting. I'm sorry I didn't see it, but
you're working. I understand.
Well, I'm traveling. Yeah, it's one of the problems.
Certainly,
here,
we should all really, really hope that the military vote from overseas gets counted this year. I really think so. Yeah.
Yeah, and thanks, Chris. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. And there was a story. I don't have it right here in front of me. I just read it yesterday. I believe it's on commondreams.org. It's one of the stories you can find there about how the many Americans overseas are not going to be allowed to vote using the system that the military has put in place for absentee balloting. Apparently, they just want the military to use it because so many of the civilians presumably would vote democratically. I mean, the because there is my not just my, but you know, is kind of a broad concern about this, that the vote is being rigged in advance all over again. We're seeing the disenfranchisement of African Americans. We'll get into this tomorrow. This is really a fascinating story, actually, and I've got a bunch of detail on it. I just don't have it right here in front of me, so I'll share it with you tomorrow. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Kevin in Santa Fe on the line one here. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Wondering if you guys have seen the latest Swift boat ads in New Mexico.
We don't get them in Vermont because they don't bother to spend money in Vermont because they know Vermont's going to go for Kerry no matter what. So, no, I have not seen them.
They're accusing Kerry of collaborating with the enemy in Paris while the war is still going on.
The interesting thing
is they're showing pictures of, while they're doing that, they're showing pictures of Jane Fonda in Hanoi.
Yeah, well, this is the old NLP trick. I mean, this is what they did with Willie Horton and Michael Dukakis, and this is what they did with Max Cleveland and Osama bin Laden. You don't actually have to morph a face from one to another. All you have to do is show a couple of pictures within a few seconds of each other repeatedly, and it starts to make an impression in people's minds. This is one of the reasons why. Well, Louise and I were watching an ad the other day from one of the PACs. I think it was Move On. About how Bush has gotten us into this quagmire. Have you seen that ad where the soldier's running across the desert and he ends up to his chest in quicksand?
Yes. Yeah, I've seen that.
Okay. As I was watching that, I turned to Louise and I said they need to be superimposing a picture of George Bush every 5 or 10 seconds to imprint this in people's brains. And the Republicans understand about neurolinguistic programming. They understand about framing. They understand about psychological warfare. And frankly, I'm using phrases here that have a negative appellation, but you know, these are also the fundamental tools of advertising and marketing. The Republicans understand this. Why don't the Democrats?
I know. I'd love to see a picture of the 9/11 incident with George Bush imposed on the front of it, and somebody saying you ought to hang your head in shame.
Yeah. It's absolutely, or a quote thereof. I mean, it's time for us to start. Number one, reframing the argument, and number two, telling the truth about what's going on in a way that is just absolutely clear and unambiguous.
Real quickly, I found these ads appalling. And as an independent voter, hey, they finally swayed me. I'm going to vote for John Kerry, and I may never vote for a Republican again.
Good on you, Kevin. Good on you.
Thanks
for the call. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And by the way, lots of swift buck liars for Bush. There's always. There's always a fantastic conversation going on there in the chat room. If you haven't dropped in, you're really missing something. Anyhow, Ron in San Diego's on line 3. Hey, Ron, welcome to the Tom Hartman program. You are live and on the air. What's up?
I just wanted to make a clarification on the tax cuts.
Tax cuts? What tax cuts?
Yeah. Well, there's no tax cuts. It's a tax deferment.
There you go.
Milton Friedman, the economist, said that if you go through deficit spending, then it's not a tax cut, it's a tax deferment.
Or a tax deferral, actually, yeah.
Yeah, and our kids are going to have to pay for this.
That's right. Just like we right now are going to pay $160 billion out of our taxpayers' dollars this year, and that's enough to build a whole heck of a lot of schools and hire teachers and put probably a million kids through 4 years of college. We're going to spend $160 billion this year on interest on the money that Ronald Reagan borrowed in his first couple of terms in office in order to try and make it look like, you know, his economics had some common sense to them, which they didn't.
Exactly. And they don't.
No,
and I'm getting
they didn't then, they don't
the
know.
The Democrats letting them get away with this.
Yeah.
Fraud.
I agree. And in fact, although I've got to say, you know, economically, I am a pox on both their houses. I mean, the Republicans and the cons have created an absolute mind-boggling, terrible disaster. And you know, this whole idea of trickle-on economics, you know, it started with Reagan. It really didn't start with Reagan. It goes back to McKinley, but you know, it got reinvented under Reagan. Is destructive of the middle class. It is the fastest way to destroy the middle class. It's the fastest way to eviscerate a country. And now we are giving away the sovereignty of the United States to multinational corporations. If that isn't bad enough, now you have Democrats who are trying to do the same thing. You got the Democratic Leadership Council. You got folks, you know, Bill Clinton is spearheading this thing, signing NAFTA and GATT. You even have, you know, national so-called, you know, liberal talk show hosts saying, well, I'm a DLC Democrat. I'm like, what? It is time for us to wake up and realize the problem is not Republican or Democratic. The problem is crackpot economics that calls itself conservative economics that would make Barry Goldwater roll over in his grave and barf.
Yep, that's right.
Okay. Ron, thanks for the call. Thanks for pointing it out and getting me started on the I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. I just wanted to share with you, I had mentioned the draft before. Let's just wrap this thing up. Sitting here in the studio with our 23-year-old daughter. Guess what, Kareth? You are of draft age. Two bills pending in Congress would launch a new draft for all young Americans ages 18 to 26, both male and female, with no college exemption. Yeah, up to 26. Your brother's 26. Also, a new border agreement with Canada is designed to prevent young Americans from fleeing northward to elude the draft. Now, why would the cons, why would this administration be negotiating a new border agreement with Canada that would prevent 18 to 26-year-olds from going to Canada? Right? Why? You know, they're going to have a visa or something like that. You know, it's putting up these. Why would they be doing this now? Because they have plans for right after an aviat. I have said many times, I'm in favor of national service, but I think that national service, a compulsory national service program, I think we should have it, like they do in Germany, for example. They do in so many other countries around the world. I think that we should have it, but I think that it should be, that you should have the ability to work in a hospital, work in school, to do all sorts of things to see America, to help rebuild America, or if you want to be a warrior, go off to war, or go into the military, rather. But that's not how this thing is being set up. This thing is being set up as cannon fodder, pure and simple. Les in Huntington, West Virginia. Hang on the line there. We'll take your call right after this break. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 10 minutes before the hour, putting the con in conservative. And, yeah, it sure is in there, isn't it?
This is Veronique Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug, the phone started ringing. The first person said, whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it. And for the next few hours, the phone rang nonstop. The people who listen to your program are what they call in the business my target audience, people who are conscious and responsible and try to do the right thing and try to think for themselves. I would encourage anyone to advertise on the Thomas Hartman Show, absolutely, without question, whether that be on the national level or the local level, and you will absolutely get results. The way you can learn more about our imported organically grown wines from France is by calling us. The phone number is 1-888-ECO-WINE, or you can visit our site at www.ecowine.com.
How can contemporary America possibly compare with 1933 Germany? Find out in Tom Hartman's brand new fully illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America. Through Tom's concise political analysis and Neil Cohn's vibrant illustrations, you'll observe an unsettling, if not shocking, perspective of America. You'll also hear what the founders of this country did to control corporate power. You'll be invited to consider how the American political system can be made more democratic, as well as comprehend the Project for the New American Century's vision for America. Here's what syndicated cartoonist Ted Rawl said after reading We the People.
An ambitious effort to explain everything that's wrong in America, how things got this way, and what should be done about it. We the People is the product of a brilliant and principled thinker.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. Available in bookstores everywhere.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman. It's been said that if you scratch the surface of any issue of social or economic injustice, you'll find the issue of corporate power and corporate personhood. Join me for the facts on September 24th. I'll be speaking in Portland, Oregon at the Unitarian Church on Main Street at 7 p.m. For more information, call Marcia at 503-665-3957. That's 503-665-3957.
Can you imagine a world in which all kids live healthy, safe, productive, and prosperous lives? Well, that world is within our grasp, and there's a way to reach it. It's called Econonomics. And to learn more, just pull up DennisWeaverNow.com and learn how to get a free report of our Econonomics educational program and how together we can build a world of prosperity without pollution. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com.
This is a Workers' Independent News Service feature story. I'm Sarah Turner. In a sweeping agreement covering more than 8,000 farm workers in a federal visa worker program, the Farm Labor Organizing Committee has ended its five-year boycott of the nation's second-largest pickle company, Mount Olive.
Well, we came to terms with the company and the North Carolina Grower Association last week in an agreement that covers over 8,000 workers on over 1,000 farms in North Carolina.
President of the FLOC, Baldemar Velasquez, says they've won the largest union contract in North Carolina's history.
We have a three-step grievance procedure. We eliminated blacklisting. If they complained about something, they were put on a blacklist and then put in the government computer so the worker could never enter the country again on any kind of visa. And we have a seniority system now where workers are able to apply in order of their seniority and reclaim those jobs the next year. And the union will be overseeing this hiring effort in Mexico during the winter months. Mount Olive agreed to put out a 10% wage increase over the next 3 years. So the agreement stretches from Mexico to Ohio.
Unions, churches, and students mounted a massive pressure campaign, including picketing grocery stores. A company spokesperson said Mount Olive is very relieved the boycott is over. Velasquez believes there are two reasons the flock was successful.
They were spending more time fighting protests and other things that we did to get their attention than running their business is one reason. And the other reason is, I think, is just spiritual. We prayed fervently, and boom, the pieces just came together.
There's been no time for celebration, with only 7 full-time organizers trying to implement the labor agreement on more than 1,000 farms. The FLOC is now setting its sights on helping undocumented workers at non-Mount Olive farms. With the Workers' Independent News Service, I'm Sarah Turner.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's coming through a hole in the air.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Portland, Oregon. And let's ask the voice of the people. Here's a 23-year-old. Hey, Kareth, if the draft was passed and you were faced with going to Iraq, what do you think is going to happen here in Portland?
Well, Dad, I think probably the whole city of Portland would flee to Canada.
Ah, there you go. I'm with you. 1-866, thank you, Kareth. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Les in Huntington, West Virginia, is on the line. Hey, Les, what's up?
How are you doing today, sir? I want to concur with the comments earlier about the military people wanting George Bush gone. I don't know. I'm active duty right now. I don't know one person that wants George back.
Really?
Just for instance, we all knew, at least I knew, when George was elected that we were going to Iraq. It was. Everything was pointed to that based on the fact that he was going to win. And when he came into power, the first thing we were warned was we were going to have a 20% cutback in the military. Had 9/11 not happened, we would be a lot smaller than we are today.
I've
been a recruiter for the last 15 years. Now, the one thing I didn't like was people talking about recruiters lying. Anyone I know tells the truth. The contracts are up front. Everybody that joins has a guarantee in that contract. So they're getting what they signed for. Oftentimes they may not know what they're signing for. They don't have enough common sense.
Well, I think that's one of the problems. And I know, Les, during the Vietnam War, and I know people that this happened to, they were told, here's 172 job descriptions. Pick 3. You can pick your favorite ones. We'll try and get them for you. And then once they got into basic training, they were told, we need dog handlers, and that's it. Or we need infantry, and, you know.
Well,
the needs of the military supersede your choice.
In my service, the contract is up front. They can't change it. Now, there are services that do that, that you come to open contract, but we don't have that.
I see. Okay, well, I stand corrected. Thank you for putting
like
that out.
Just like another item you brought up was the IRR, the Inactive Ready Reserve.
Yes, sir.
When you join the military, you have an 8-year commitment. If whatever time you don't serve on active duty or in a reserve component, you go on the IRR. It finishes after 8 years. They don't hold them beyond that point. So
why is it that 40 and 50 year olds are getting called up on the IRR?
Because they came out of the reserves and still had some time left. They just they chose to stay in the inactive ready reserve. I know a 54 year old that decided to come back in the Army Reserve. he came in as a cook, but because he was an artillery before that, they sent him off to war as an artillery specialist.
I see.
And he was not ready for it, not fit for it, but they sent him anyway.
Yeah, it's an old story. Les, thanks for the good truth-telling here and for keeping us straight. I do appreciate it. And thanks for listening to us there in Huntington, West Virginia on WRCV. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Thank you for being with us today. Thanks to Louise for producing our program. Thanks to Ira Gravatt and Rama Schneider back in Vermont for engineering the program. Thanks to Kareth Hartman for showing up and helping us out. Thanks to the folks at KBOO in Portland, Oregon for loaning us a studio to do the program from. Thanks to you for listening. We'll be back here tomorrow, live, same time, same place. See you here then.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Visit iowapeace.com for books on justice and peace. The Last Liberal Outlaw is Mike Palasek's new novel. Chuck Gregory with BlueEar.com had this to say. Palasek is at his best when writing about small-town America. It's a place he clearly loves, even as he pokes fun at its quirks and reveals the sickness that lies just below the surface. It's a place he knows, and he shares his knowledge in delightfully original ways, even as he cries out for change. We haven't had a writer like Palasek since Kurt Vonnegut was at his peak. Mike is an Iowa author, former federal prisoner for peace, small-town newspaper reporter, seminarian, and nominee for the U.S. House of Representatives in the Iowa Democratic Party 2000 election. For more information and more about Mike's other novels, visit iowapeace.com. The revolution won't be televised, but you can read about it. The Last Liberal Outlaw, A New American Revolution, is happening.
Pop and not so.